You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Is something happening? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
The key to the whole game of Wall Street and the gods of money is debt slavery. The key to the whole game. The thing that Reaganomics said is irrelevant is the central point about the whole game of bankers since the creation of Babylonian banking. It's debt. Debt slavery.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, William Engdahl. Today's show, The Power of Money. William Engdahl is an international political analyst and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss his book, The Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century. William Engdahl, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you again, Bonnie.
In your introduction to Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, you write that this book is not a conventional account of money, banking, or economics, but rather a history of power, a history of the colossal abuse of power in the hands of the gods of money. Who and what are you referring to as the gods of money?
What I refer to and what I trace out in the book from the earliest beginnings, in fact, with the Alexander Hamilton First National Bank of the United States, which wasn't a national bank but was a Rothschild bank, what I trace out is the gods of money are the international bankers that buy and sell nations. They finance wars like the Napoleonic Wars, the War of 1812 against the United States when the U.S. was abandoning the Rothschild Bank of the United States. And these so-called gods of money see themselves as above nations, above people, literally as gods. And there's an expression by Henry Kissinger back in the 1970s, when he was at the zenith of his power. He said, if you control the oil, you control nations or groups of nations. If you control the food, you control the people. If you control the money, you control the entire world. And that, in essence, is the agenda of the gods of money, what I call the gods of money. That's with a small g, by the way.
You write that money is nothing more and nothing less than a political creation, a promise to pay, backed up by the government and its military power, and obviously also it's the government's ability to tax that gives it such enormous power. But if the government is what backs up the value of money, then how is it that banking is in private hands?
Well, that's the great mystery of the last, I would say, 500 years of Western civilization. When the city of London began to rise in the 1690s with the Bank of England and so forth, these were private merchant bankers creating a bank called the Bank of England, and they lent to the crown to finance wars against France, against whoever. And because the crown did not understand the power of money, they didn't. Most governments, including the communist governments, Karl Marx, years ago I studied when I was in Sweden, I studied Das Kapital and Karl Marx, and Karl Marx never understood the fundamentals, or didn't want to understand, of central banking and the creation of money. And this is kind of the secret of secrets, the inner sanctum of power that we never seem to get our hands around. They're a bunch of gangsters and crooks called the gods of money, or the banks of Wall Street. There are only about seven of them, really. There's Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, four or five others, J.P. Morgan Chase, and so on. And they have systematically, over the course of the period since World War II, step by step created a silent coup d'etat, taking over every institution of influence in the American body politic. They've ripped up the Constitution. They've financed wars, the wars in the Middle East and so forth. They stand behind the military-industrial complex that is booming these days because of all the wars. And they control the Federal Reserve. They created the Federal Reserve. You know, many people have the illusion or the wrong information that the Federal Reserve is a solemn U.S. government institution. It's nothing of the sort. It's a private central bank controlled by private capital, controlled by J.P. Morgan Chase, by AIG at times, and so forth. And its stock is owned privately. The central bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, being the most powerful of the various reserve banks. So if you can control the power of money, the Constitution of the United States is a fairly decent document as these things go. And the founding fathers gave the power to print and coin money to the Congress of the United States. Well, in December of 1913, in a coup d'etat, J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Bank, with Woodrow Wilson as their hired hand, their paid gun, created the Federal Reserve Act that took that power away from the elected U.S. Congress and put it in the hands of the private bankers, the international bankers of Wall Street. And those are who I refer to as the gods of money with a small g, because they see themselves as gods. Maybe the title, if I were to rewrite the book today, I would probably change the title, because it gives them too much respect, because they are no gods. They're pathological. If you look at people like David Rockefeller or the chairman of Goldman Sachs, or the chairman of Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, these are psychopaths. These are people without any emotions whatsoever.
You often quote Henry Kissinger's famous line, which you've mentioned, that if you control the money, you control the entire world. How is it that control of the currency turns out to be the most powerful control, even more than oil and food?
Go back, Bonnie, to the Bretton Woods conference in 1944. That conference was run by the U.S. Treasury and the four or five international Wall Street banks, especially the Rockefeller Citigroup. And what they arranged was that the entire free world monetary order of Bretton Woods would be oriented toward the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar would be the only currency convertible for gold. The dollar was, quote, as good as gold. And at that time, the Federal Reserve held something like 70% of the monetary gold in the entire world. So they were sitting in hog heaven. You know, there was no challenger on the face. Europe was a rubble heap after the war. Japan was in ashes, thermonuclear ashes, thanks to Harry Truman and the Pentagon. China was undergoing an internal revolution. Soviet Union was devastated, 27 or 29 million killed in order to win World War II for the United States, effectively. So at that point, they created a system that was based on the dollar. And if the dollar is the reserve currency held by every other nation's central bank, then they have to finance everything, all their trade, their purchase of oil, their purchase of raw materials on the world market in dollars. So they have to come up with those dollars somewhere. And that creates a demand for dollars that allows the United States to run a balance of payments deficit since 1971, almost every single year, with the exception of one or two years during Clinton's regime when the Social Security baby boom spike created a little bit of a surplus. So the dollar as reserve currency is one of two pillars, as I often write in my articles and books, two pillars of American hegemony or American power. The second pillar is that the U.S. military shall be second to none in the world. So those two, the dollar is reserve. What does that mean, dollar is reserve currency, if the U.S. runs a deficit? Well, China has a trade surplus. Germany has a trade surplus. What do they do with the surplus dollars? They buy U.S. Treasury bonds. What does that allow the U.S. government to do? Run a deficit without even blinking an eye, so that the Chinese de facto are financing U.S. military operations that are against Chinese national interests, that are against German national interests in NATO and so forth. The coup d'etat in Ukraine in 2014, a good example of that. German industry suffered grievously from that coup d'etat. But that is because the dollar is reserve currency, still to this day. Now, the euro, back in 2000 or so, when it 2002, when it became a functioning alternative currency, even though it had grave flaws in its design, there was no political central government for United States of Europe like in the U.S. of A. But despite that, the euro was on its way to become an alternative to the dollar, because at that point, George W. Bush was running, after the 2008 financial crisis, was running annual deficits of $1 trillion, $1.3 trillion. It was just skyrocketing out of control. The Chinese said, we are not at all amused by the level of indebtedness of the U.S. government, because our previous investments in U.S. debt is becoming endangered if this continues. And they started moving their surplus, trade surplus, into euros. And at that point, Washington, the U.S. Treasury Financial Warfare Unit and so forth, reacted together with Wall Street with an attack on the weak link of the euro, namely the Greek debt, fraudulent Greek debt, which Goldman Sachs had arranged for the Greek government a few years before. So this is the kind of thing, if you can create money out of thin air and everybody else is required to get that money, that U.S. dollar, then you have a power that is awesome.
Yes, it is ironic that, as you point out, it's the U.S. government's indebtedness because of the reserve currency status of the dollar. Other countries are having to finance the U.S. military to attack them.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works out. And only slowly are they beginning to realize this. The Chinese, I think, began to realize this around 6 or 7 years ago. But they had so much more than $1 trillion invested in U.S. Treasury debt if they dump it all at once, you know, some people say, oh, dump it all at once, you know, bankrupt the U.S. No, it doesn't work that way. If they do that, then China will go through a horrendous financial crisis. So they have to figure out some way. And what they're doing is buying gold, the same as the Russians. They're buying every bar of gold they can get their hands on in the market. The cheaper, the better, but even if they pay a premium. And ultimately working toward creating a gold-backed renminbi or yuan as an alternative to the dollar at a point where the dollar becomes recognized worldwide as a completely worthless paper currency.
One thing that I never completely understood is why it is that the central banks of other countries use their surplus dollars to buy U.S. Treasury notes. Is there nowhere else for them to put those dollars?
Not in the dimensions, for example, China, or before that in the 80s, it was Japan. They had tens or hundreds of billions of dollars in trade surplus, mostly with the U.S. That was the diabolical thing. You know, you can buy Japanese cars in the U.S. They said, oh, come on in. We don't care about Detroit. You know, buy our cars because you'll finance our debt. And we can make wars and take over other countries and loot them. And, you know, it works out okay. And that's kind of how it works. So there are almost no alternatives. The euro was the most promising potential alternative back in 2007, 2008. And money was going into the euro from Japan, from China, from Russia, from other countries to buy bonds of the European governments. And that's why the Greek crisis was triggered by the U.S. Treasury Financial Warfare Unit in 2010 to stop the attraction of the euro as an alternative to the dollar. And it pretty well succeeded short term.
Well, is the Wall Street financial warfare against the EU, against the euro, that is that continuing today?
Sure. I think I wrote a piece on this recently, but the comments of Trump's economic team, Peter Navarro, among them, especially, about Germany being a currency manipulator. This is kind of code language, and you really have to dig a little bit behind the surface to figure out what they're talking about. But what they're talking about, if you read certain position papers that Peter Navarro, who's the trade czar now under Trump, he wrote in September of last year before the election, de facto, the creation of the euro makes Germany the king of the hill, makes Germany a currency manipulator. And, of course, the German government, completely shocked by this attack, says, no, we have no power. It's the European Central Bank that is creating the currency valuation of the euro. And by treaty, Maastricht Treaty, we have no power over Mario Draghi, former Goldman Sachs banker, who is the head of the European Central Bank and is doing these credit operations, these buying of you know, worthless debt of the banks of Europe and the stocks of Europe. So, in effect, what the Trump administration is doing is targeting the euro itself for demolition. And that will create quite a bit of disruption in the European economies, I can assure you. But they smell that this is the Achilles heel, that to eliminate any potential future threat to the hegemony of the U.S. dollar, they should just finish off this euro thing once and for all. It's an artificial supranational currency with no supranational government behind it. The European Parliament is a joke. They pretend to have some power, but it's a joke. The national governments still tenaciously hold on to what power they still have vis-a-vis Brussels. France, under Marine Le Pen, if she becomes president, will leave the euro. And if France leaves the euro, it's over. It's over. And that's a not so unbelievable prospect. So the Brexit began the tumbling of the dominoes called the Eurozone. And I think the European Union, believe me, I'm for stability and tranquility and all these things. The European Union is a Frankenstein monster. It has nothing to do with the original intent of Charles de Gaulle or Adenauer back in the 60s when they talked about a Europe of the fatherlands, where national sovereignty would be the foundation stone of cooperation agreements between the member nations, that time 6 or 7. Now it's become this undemocratic, unelected, faceless, supranational bureaucracy of de facto, let's call it what it is, fascists, who want top-down control over every facet of life of citizens in the countries of the European Union. They want to dictate to countries such as Hungary or Germany or whoever how many war refugees they must take and integrate into their economies. Well, what is this all about? You know, who's causing the wars? It's NATO. Who's causing the Arab Spring? Who's causing this Syria thing? It's the United States Pentagon. It's the CIA. It's the State Department. It's Turkey. It's Qatar. It's Saudi Arabia. So why should Europe have to accept millions of war-crazed refugees, many of them terrorists? What is this? This isn't about humanitarianism. Never a country in the world opens its borders to anybody without questions asked. America never did that. You have to have certain criterion of who you want to be a citizen in your country, who you deem can assimilate into your culture, learn your language, and so forth. But in Europe, Angela Merkel and the governments in Brussels have just opened the floodgates because certain interests like George Soros, the European Council on Foreign Relations and so forth, the Vatican, Pope Francis, they want to destroy national identity. And I think borders matter. I think national identity matters. And I think national currencies matter. Not supranational things like the Euro or the Brussels Commission or the European Parliament that has no connection to voters.
I'm speaking with William Engdahl. He is the author of Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And, of course, if you've been listening consistently to KPFA, you'll know that we are just beginning our fund drive, and I'm coming to you today to ask for your support to support Guns and Butter, to support KPFA, the radio station that brings you Guns and Butter every week. We're offering today, and I'm very excited about it, this almost 400-page book, Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century, by William Engdahl, for a tax-deductible pledge to KPFA of $110. $110. That will go a long way toward keeping Guns and Butter on the air, to keep KPFA continuing to broadcast, to help us to continue to bring terrific content to you every week on Guns and Butter. Please support the station, support the show. Please call 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732 to pledge your financial support, your tax-deductible financial support to KPFA today. This book is incredible, The Gods of Money. I want to read a little bit out of William Engdahl's introduction. In November 2009, interview with the London Sunday Times, Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman and CEO of the world's most profitable bank, Goldman Sachs, defended his bank's record profits at a time when most financial institutions were struggling to survive. He commented that he was merely a, quote, banker doing God's work, unquote. More than a century earlier, John D. Rockefeller, the founder of the Standard Oil monopoly, when asked by a naive reporter how he had become the world's wealthiest man, snapped back without hesitation, God gave me my money. Books have been written attempting to define the most fundamental question, what is money? The fact that so many different answers and so many different books exist demonstrates that the true nature of something most of us take for granted is not at all clear, at least to academic economists. The Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, almost 400 pages long by William Engdahl. He's an incredible geostrategist, a wonderful scholar. The information that he has dug up that is in this very readable book is mind-blowing. In The Gods of Money, he begins with the creation of the first bank of the United States that was set up by Alexander Hamilton. He goes through the Civil War, the creation of the second bank of the United States, the second, privately owned bank. And that charter was not renewed by President Andrew Jackson. It was not until 1913, with the creation of the Federal Reserve, voted in by an almost empty Congress, I believe on Christmas Eve, December 1913, and ever since, we have been dominated by this private banking conglomerate. And it's hard to believe that here we are in the second decade of the 21st century and the scam is continuing. But you can read all about it and finally understand what money is and the history of money and the geopolitics, the wars that are created by the funding from private bankers. Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century by William Engdahl, our gift to you today for a donation to KPFA of $110, 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. And I went on there and looked for Gods of Money. And I see that when you pledge online, you need to click on books. And if you go into the books section, there it is, The Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century by William Engdahl. And let me read the jacket, a little bit about what's in this book. This is a book about power and about an extraordinarily wealthy elite that has wielded unprecedented power, not for the good, but rather for the enhancement of their own private position. The book tracks the evolution of the power amassed by a tiny group of men who have regarded themselves quite literally as gods, the gods of money. Their agenda has included assassinations of two of America's most popular presidents. We're going to talk about that a little later in the show. Involvement of the United States against the public will in two world wars, and detonation of the world's most destructive weapon, the atomic bomb, on Japanese civilians. It has included scores of regional wars, political assassinations, coups, and systematic corruption of the body politic. The book reveals how this powerful elite has systematically set out to literally control the entire world, backed by the most powerful military force the world has ever seen. The Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century by William Engdahl. I cannot recommend this book highly enough. I have not read all of William Engdahl's books, but of the ones that I have, this is by far my favorite. It's not only a history of money, of finance, of monetary systems, of the Federal Reserve. It's also a geopolitical history of the United States and the world, beginning with the formation of the first bank of the United States under Alexander Hamilton. 1-800-439-5732 to pledge your financial support to KPFA. Where else are you going to hear about what is money? What is money, really? This is the most hidden subject there is. It turns out that American citizens in the 18th and 19th century were much more they were much more hip about what money was, and they got rid of these privately controlled central banks twice. And as I said before, it wasn't until 1913 that we got stuck with the Federal Reserve, a privately owned central bank, and I guess it's been over 100 years now, and we still have the Federal Reserve. The gods of money, Wall Street, and the death of the American century lays it all out. It's an incredible book. 1-800-439-5732. Please support non-commercial, listener-supported radio. Our Pacifica network is so very dear to us. I got up myself about 5 o'clock this morning to help raise money for our New York station, WBAI, and it was a great outpouring of support for Guns and Butter for our New York station, and I would love to be able to bring in support for KPFA here in California. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today's show is The Power of Money with William Engdahl, who wrote Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century. Another person wrote of this book, William Engdahl's work gives a rich history of a very old and deep system, one that has drained great wealth from our ancestors as well as from us. This book is an invaluable contribution to our understanding of where we are today, not to mention an excellent read. It really is an excellent read. You'll get a lot of history out of it, a lot of explanation, and there is stuff in here that I've never read anywhere before, and I want to bring up some of these assassinations later in the show. It's really quite mind-blowing. And here is another paragraph from William Engdahl's introduction. The edifice that has developed within the United States over the course of the past 150 years is one where an inordinately powerful small circle of international bankers, the powers of Wall Street and the money center banks allied to it, has shaped the lives of the American public, prepared them for wars far from American shores, literally controlling what people buy and produce, and most dangerously, even what they are allowed to think. The late American historian Carol Quigley noted, the aim of the international bankers was nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. And William Engdahl, of course, writes, and we also speak about in this interview with him, what it would be like if our central bank, if we didn't have a central bank, if we had a treasury of the United States government that controlled the money, and how that would affect the economy for the better. 1-800-439-5732 to pledge your support for KPFA. A $25 donation, of course, makes you a member of KPFA for a year. Donations in any amount are welcome. Even donations in the smallest amount, it all adds up. 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to thank all of those of you who have called in to pledge your support to KPFA today, not just on Guns and Butter, but ever since we started this pledge drive. You can also go to kpfa.org and look under books and find this and pledge there. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, today I'm speaking with William Engdahl. And what I am thinking, Erica, is maybe we should go and listen to another bit of this interview with William Engdahl.
You write that Gods of Money, your book, chronicles the rise of the American century from the period following the Civil War to the debacle today that signals the death of that American century. Your chapter, An American Money Oligarchy Emerges, covers the beginning of national banking in the United States through the Civil War. The first bank of the United States was designed by Alexander Hamilton, modeled on the Bank of England. Benjamin Franklin had blocked the charter of this bank until his death. Why did Benjamin Franklin object?
Because Benjamin Franklin wanted an American institution. And Hamilton was, a British monarchist at heart. He, in the charter of the First National Bank of the United States, shareholders, stock owners of that bank were open to international banking, and that meant the city of London came in through the back door, the Rothschild, which is the dominant merchant bank of the city of London at that time, and the other banks, Barings and so forth, could buy the stock of the Bank of the United States. It wasn't a national bank. It was a private bank with private stockholders. And it was all about taking back what the American Revolution won from the British, national sovereignty. It was about taking that back through the money door. And very few American historians understand that. Most of them think, oh, Bank of the United States, that's good. That's American. Hamilton was a traitor. Hamilton was a criminal in the true sense of American national interest.
The renewal of the charter of that first Bank of the United States was not renewed. Then there was a second Bank of the United States. In 1832, President Andrew Jackson vetoed the renewal of the second Bank of the United States, but the private bankers fought back. What happened there?
Jackson, in a gut sense, Jackson was not the deepest humanist of any president, but in a gut sense, he realized that the Bank of the United States was a private institution that was destroying the power of the United States. So he refused. He said, if there's one thing I'm going to do as president, it's to kill the second Bank of the United States. And he did that. And it took Wall Street until 1913 to recover from that blow by creating the Federal Reserve as a private bank masquerading in drag as a Federal Reserve Bank of the United States.
You go through a lot of banking panics in the late 19th century in your book, Gods of Money, including the financial panic of 1837. What are banking panics and what causes them?
Bankers cause banking panics. J.P. Morgan was responsible for most of them. They create a panic, they create a depression in the economy, and then they put pressure on politicians to pass laws favorable to those banks. And that's what happened in every single banking panic up until the panic of 1910 that led to the creation of the Federal Reserve.
How does the expansion and contraction of the money supply create booms and busts, or what is called the business cycle? How is the lending power of banks used to create deflationary recessions and depressions?
Well, you just said it. If I flood the market with cheap money, people take that money and they buy houses, they flip those houses, the money keeps flowing, so somebody buys the flipped house, and the price goes up even more, and there's no new value added to that physical piece of real estate, but the market price is going up. So as long as the capital flows, it's a party with a huge punch bowl. But when somebody takes away the punch bowl, the central bank, and pulls back the money supply, suddenly nobody can pay their debts because this is all based on debt. The key to the whole game of Wall Street and the gods of money is debt slavery. the key to the whole game, the thing that Reaganomics said is irrelevant, is the central point about the whole game of bankers since the creation of Babylonian banking. It's debt. Debt slavery.
Now, how do banks flood the economy with money? Is it simply by making a lot of loans?
Yes. Well, it's called the fractional reserve banking system. You can make loans against capital of, it's changed a little bit in recent years, but between 8% and 11%, you can multiply that manifold and simply create money out of thin air, the banks. And then the Federal Reserve is kind of the governor or the policeman to keep that within certain bounds. But under Greenspan, those boundaries were more or less abolished. So the key to the thing, I think, was the decision of the U.S. government to agree that Wall Street bankers, international bankers in Wall Street, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and so forth, would buy the debt to the United States and resell it. So private bankers would make the profit. And a secretary of the U.S. Treasury around the time of President Lincoln suggested, well, if the U.S. Treasury created a fund of, I don't know, he said X hundred million dollars, but let's say a few billion dollars in today's money, and we use that as collateral to issue the debt of the United States directly to citizens, we don't need these private bankers to rake off 40, 30, 25, 50% profits on the backs of the U.S. taxpayer. Well, that got deep-sixed by the power of J.P. Morgan and others. And they create banking panics to panic politicians to increase their control. It's very simple, really. If you control the money, you control the world. If you're dependent on money in your job, and I say, I cut you off, you don't get any money, what do? You're in a panic. Tell me you're not. Yes. Okay, what do I have to do, sir? What do I have to do to change to get my job back? Well, you do that with the whole nation through the money supply, the central money supply. That's why the gods of money created the Federal Reserve as a private instrument to control the money supply and take it away from the entity that the Constitution of the United States mandated, namely the elected U.S. Congress. The point about money is that money is nothing more since the 1600s and the Bank of Amsterdam and the fractional reserve banking invention, where you have only a fraction of the money you lend out in gold in your vaults at any one time in Amsterdam back then, but you lend out 8 or 11 times that amount because you calculate nobody is going to demand all of that at one time. I mean, that would require a collapse of the world of Amsterdam, but that happened, by the way. So the fractional reserve banking system collapses periodically about every 10 years or so, and the same thing repeats itself, and the power of those banks increases and increases because they create money out of thin air, and that money is a promise to pay. Backed by what? Since 1971, August, the U.S. dollar is backed not by gold, no longer. It was backed by oil revenues after the 1973 oil shock, which Henry Kissinger managed to manipulate. And then, in the present day, I would say the dollar is backed by nothing more than the power of Abrams tanks and F-16 fighter jets, raw military power on the rest of the world. And you accept those promises to pay called U.S. Federal Reserve notes that are worthless pieces of paper. Look at the size of the federal debt of the United States government. What is it, $19 trillion today? What was it 10 years ago? What was it 20 years ago? Put that on a graph and look at the trend, and you get an idea that something is really rotten in the state of the United States. And it's called debt.
The last chapter in Gods of Money deals with some of the similarities between America's current situation and that at the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. For one thing, you mentioned that both empires relied on looting and plunder to sustain themselves. What are some of the other similarities?
Well, the indebtedness, the destruction of citizen farmers, they were forced to go to war to extend the Roman Empire to the borders of France and England and East Germany and so forth, and to loot that to feed this parasitical class called the Roman senators, the Roman patriarchy. And in Rome itself, it was just debauchery, corruption. You buy and sell senators and offices and so forth. It was a slave society. It wasn't always that way. At the time of Julius Caesar, it was quite other. But step by step, the money interests took over and destroyed anything positive in Rome. And that's very similar to what the banks have done over the past 40, 45 years to anything positive in the United States of America. Follow the sequel, 1999. The Bill Clinton administration abolishes the Great Depression laws called Glass-Steagall, which mandated a separation between investment banks that buy and sell stocks and bonds from commercial banks that finance corporations. And you had the growth of the power of the six or seven mega banks of Wall Street after 1999 and Bill Clinton's great signing of that disgusting act, such that the balance sheets of those six or seven banks are larger than the gross domestic product of most of the nations of the world. This is crazy. You give so much power, and then they come up with this nonsense doctrine, too big to fail. I say they're too big to save. Let's nationalize them. Let's carve them up, chop them down to size, take away all their power so they can't buy and sell presidents. They can't buy and sell congressmen on the banking committee and other committees to extend their power. This goes back to Babylon. This is the power of money. This is the power of debt slavery. And the banks, that's what destroyed the British Empire, what destroyed the Dutch Empire. It's what destroyed Venice, and it's what's destroying, if we allow it, the United States of America. Simple as that. Look at the banks. Look at those bankers. Why aren't they in jail? Why isn't Jamie Dimon doing a stiff sentence in prison, the chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase? Why is he sitting there with a grin on his face today? Because we allow him to. We feel pathetic. We feel powerless. And these people have no power. They have only the power that we give them. So the empire of the United States and the empire of Rome are similar in so many ways. And the corruption in Rome and the corruption in Washington, I won't begin to talk about it, but it's so similar. Compare Washington of the 1950s or the early 1960s with Washington today. With the kind of scandals you have, the sex scandals, the pederasty scandals, you name it, and the corruption scandals, money under the table, and so forth. It's Rome in the fourth century.
Well, then, essentially, having a central bank underneath the U.S. Treasury and then having the government itself have the power to create credit, that would be a better system, right?
Far better. Far better, but I would call it not a central bank, a national bank. A real national bank controlled by the nation with the electorate having the power to vote in or vote out presidents and Congress who misused the powers of that national bank. And that's what the founding fathers had intended with the Constitution. Woodrow Wilson signed that away in December 1913 because he was bought and paid for by J.P. Morgan and Company at Wall Street. Simply time to take that power back for the American people in an intelligent way. Take those six or seven banks that are destroying the nation, nationalize them as a national security priority, not as some socialist thing like Henry Paulson claimed it was. A national security priority for the good of the nation, the survival of the nation. Get rid of their toxic debt, put it into a fish tank and sort it out over the course of the next 20 to 30 years, what real estate is worth and what is not. And use the power of the state, the good power of the government, to do something positive. I say the better thing is to use credit to create productive economic projects like high-speed rail lines, like infrastructure. America has an $8 trillion estimated infrastructure deficit. Now we have the private power of robber banks. It's the robber barons all over again, destroying the nation and saying it's free enterprise, it's free for them. That's, I think, a good beginning. If I were a president and wanted to drain the swamp, I would start with the seven banks of Wall Street.
That's William Engdahl. We're talking about his book, Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You, of course, are listening to Guns and Butter. We're coming to you this Wednesday to ask for your financial support for free speech, non-commercial radio, KPFA, part of the Pacifica Network. We're offering William Engdahl's book, Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century, for a pledge of $110 to KPFA. That pledge, of course, is tax deductible. I would love to get a few more of you on the phone to help out KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. If you're looking for Gods of Money, you'll have to click on the books section, and there you will find it for a $110 tax deductible pledge. I'd like to thank each and every one of you who have called in to support KPFA today. 1-800-439-5732. Let's get a few more people on the phone. Oh, I'm running a little late here. I see we've only got 7 minutes left till the top of the hour. So please, please go to your phone. I know I've played an awful lot of audio today from my interview with William Engdahl, and a lot of you get caught up listening to the interview and don't call in. So now's your chance. Please call 1-800-439-5732 for this incredible, almost 400-page book, Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century. I cannot recommend it highly enough. We mentioned in the book jacket, mentioned a couple of assassinations of American presidents. Let me read you this out of Gods of Money. On April 14th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, shot down in cold blood in a Washington theater just 5 days after Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia. As with the assassination of John Kennedy, almost a century later, a lone gunman, John Wilkes Booth, was blamed. There was no serious congressional investigation into the issue of conspiracy and who might have been behind the assassination. In 1934, a Canadian attorney named Gerald McGreer obtained highly sensitive information about the identity of John Wilkes Booth, evidence that had been deleted from the public record at Booth's trial. The evidence was provided to McGreer by Secret Service agents after Booth's death. It showed that John Wilkes Booth was a mercenary working for the international bankers. In a speech to the Canadian Parliament, he said this, Abraham Lincoln, the murdered emancipator of the slaves, was assassinated through the machinations of a group representative of the international bankers who feared the United States president's national credit ambitions. There was only one group in the world at that time who had any reason to desire the death of Lincoln. They were the men opposed to his national currency program and who had fought him throughout the whole Civil War on his policy of greenback currency. That all suggested that Lincoln was killed as a result of his monetary policies. Lincoln needed money to finance the Civil War. European bankers, led by the Rothschilds, had offered Lincoln loans, but at usuriously high interest rates. Rather than accept the loans, Lincoln found other means to fund the war effort using the power of the state. That is from William Engdahl's Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century. KPFA's gift to you today on Guns and Butter for a generous tax-deductible pledge of $110. 1-800-439-5732. Please give us a call. I'm not in the station today, unfortunately, so I can't read off the names of those who have called in to generously support KPFA, but thank you so much. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Just look for the book section, click on that, and you can find Gods of Money. Now, speaking of assassinations, we just talked about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. There was also something to do with monetary policy when it comes to the assassination of John Kennedy. Get this. 5 months before the assassination, by what was decades later revealed to have been a CIA hit team, Kennedy issued an all but unknown proclamation which may have cost him his life. Much as Abraham Lincoln did when he avoided dependence on London bank loans to finance the Civil War and instead issued interest-free U.S. Treasury notes, greenbacks, to finance the war, President Kennedy issued Executive Order 11110 on June 4, 1963. Kennedy's Executive Order 11110, which did not require a vote of Congress, mandated the U.S. Treasury to issue silver certificates against any silver bullion, silver or standard silver dollars in the Treasury. This meant that for every ounce of silver in the U.S. Treasury's vault, the government could introduce new money into circulation. In all, Kennedy brought nearly $4.3 billion in U.S. notes into circulation in $2 and $5 denominations. The $10 and $20 United States notes were just in the process of being printed by the Treasury Department when Kennedy was assassinated. They were never circulated. It was the first time since Lincoln that a president had issued interest-free money, and the first time a president had challenged the sole money power of the private Federal Reserve. At the time of Kennedy's presidency, William McChesney Martin was chairman of the Federal Reserve. When Martin left Washington in 1970 as the longest-serving Federal Reserve head, he became a director of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Rockefeller Family Fund as well. The Fed and the Rockefellers were one small, close family. After JFK's death, Executive Order 011110 was put into abeyance. No more silver certificates were issued, and those that had been issued were removed from circulation.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is, ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Dr. Helen Caldicott is perhaps our preeminent anti-nuke crusader. Today, we'll hear a great talk she gave in November, plus some appropriate music by satirist Tom Lehrer, circa 1965. I hope you'll stay tuned. I was ruminating just the other day. Yep, it's not just cows that ruminate, but also graying ex-hippies. We develop a rumen in our late 50s. You could look it up. Anyway, while ruminating, I thought of Dr. Spock. No, not the nutcase on Star Trek. The pediatrician, author of the extremely popular book Baby and Child Care, which every mother in the 1950s relied on, including my own. A pretty good book, incidentally. In the 1970s, Dr. Benjamin Spock was a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War. That commie traitor. Naturally, the day's right-wing war hawk pundits attributed the anti-war rebellion of the young men to the, quote, over-permissiveness, unquote, supposedly championed by Dr. Spock's book. The good doctor died in 1998. Does he have a successor? I think he does. The Australian pediatrician, Dr. Helen Caldicott. True, unlike Dr. Spock, Caldicott never became a household word in child-rearing or pediatric health care, but she has become even more renowned than he as a social reformer. Caldicott is renowned as an advocate for sane nuclear energy and sane nuclear weapons, which is to say, no nuclear energy and no nuclear weapons. To her list of crusades, we must now add a third, global warming. And no, Caldicott patiently explains, reversing global warming should not involve promoting nuclear-generated electricity. Caldicott was in Houston on November 12 to receive an annual Peacemakers Award. The award wasn't as prestigious as that Norwegian Peace Prize awarded to such renowned peacemakers as Henry Kissinger and Barack H. Obama, though not to the Mahatma Gandhi. In any case, Caldicott was awarded a prize. We'll hear a speech she gave on the occasion, plus World War III's greatest marching song. In her Houston speech, Caldicott focuses on three related crises: global warming, militarization, nuclear war, and nuclear weapons, and nuclear power. She also wanders into overpopulation, but that's a bit of a digression. Dr. Spock lives, and here she is. No, that's not fair. Helen Caldicott lives, and here she is.
I'm talking to you tonight as a doctor, medical doctor, a pediatrician. And we all are aware that the Earth is in the intensive care unit. It's acutely ill, and we are all now physicians to a dying planet. And if we don't act soon, it will be too late. Most of us in this room are older, with grey hair. I've got 7 grandchildren, you've got 1. We're talking about our grandchildren and all future generations and 30 million other species that cohabit the planet with us. The elephants, the lions and tigers, the kangaroos which hop around my front garden. So we have a huge task ahead. America, for some strange reason, has elected a most inappropriate Congress. Inappropriate in terms of saving the planet, which is in the intensive care unit. Almost all of them are scientifically and medically illiterate. It is totally inappropriate to have people in the Congress and the Senate who are scientifically and medically illiterate in this day and age, when science and applied science has brought the world to this stand. I also understand that I'm in the oil capital of the world, which rather freaks me out, because it's time we stop burning oil and coal, or there will be no future. So the first thing, there are 3 issues facing the planet, and if we don't fix them, We're all going to die. I mean, I'm going to die soon anyway because I'm 72, but I mean all of us. Yeah. So the first one is global warming. I'm not going to go through that. It's all obvious to everyone. As James Hansen says, if we don't stop burning coal now, it's going to be too late. And Australia is a huge exporter of coal. You can count 27 cargo ships on the horizon, all waiting to go and load coal at Newcastle to take to China. Of course, underlying this whole problem is overpopulation. 200 years ago, there were only 1 billion Homo sapiens. There are now almost 7 billion in 200 years. That's called exponential growth. You have a lily pond with one lily, and in 1 year it duplicates. In another year, four are formed. In another year, 16. And you get to about half full, and the next doubling fills the pond. That's where we are now. And many religions in the world are against birth control. Most women in the world who are having a lot of babies, if they were educated and provided with birth control, they would stop having babies. Yet America is spending $1 trillion a year on weapons. This is a militarized society which worships death. It glorifies war. It glorifies the killers. And it's time America stopped killing along with all the rest of the planet. If we don't stop killing, we're going to blow up the earth, and I'll get onto that in a minute. Therefore, the money is available to save the planet, and it's this country that will decide whether or not we live or die. It is militarily the most powerful nation on earth, although economically it's a little like Rome, while the Tea Party is fiddle. So There's much work to be done, but the answers to saving the planet from global warming are here. I held a conference a few years ago in Washington, D.C. called Nuclear Power and Global Warming, and for 2 days we discussed it. We had the best scientists in the world talking about it, and at the end one man called David Freeman, who used to run the Tennessee Valley Authority, stood up and he said in his broad southern accent with his big cowboy hat on, "We can have all the energy America needs by 2050 with no carbon and no nuclear." And I said, "Dave, you've got to be kidding." He said, "No, we can." He was Jimmy Carter's science advisor. He put the solar panels on the roof of the White House, advised Jimmy to turn the thermostat down, and Jimmy used to wear a cardigan on television. So I commissioned a wonderful doctor called Arjun Makajani, a nuclear physicist, to do this study called Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free. And he was sceptical that, in fact, America could be carbon-free, nuclear-free. In truth, all the available technology is here right now. It's far cheaper than nuclear by orders of magnitude, and he costed it out. In America, every parking lot should be covered with solar panels. Every house in America should have solar panels for heating the water and for generating electricity. Even in Boston, in the middle of winter, where I lived for 18 years, there's enough sun in the middle of winter to power a house. Just imagine how many hundreds of thousands of people could be employed building solar panels. China's way ahead of you. So we could re-employ hundreds of thousands of people and help to save the planet. Windmills should be everywhere, everywhere. Wind farms. So they kill a few birds. So what? We're talking about the end of the planet. And people don't like the noise? Well, they'd better wear earplugs. Anyway, they hardly make any noise at all. Geothermal. There's a lot of geothermal energy here. If you want to heat and cool your house, dig a hole way down, and then you can circulate water and keeps the house cool in the summer and heats it in the winter at a constant temperature, because just below the earth, it's quite warm. And all of these technologies are here, available right now, and it's the Congress and it's the oil companies and the coal companies and the nuclear companies that run the Congress, and most of the people in Congress are corporate prostitutes. And the only way to fix it is with a revolution. Revolution is easy. I helped to lead a revolution in the 80s against nuclear war. When I first got here, Every American I talked to said, oh, well, it's better to be dead than red. I said, you want to die in a nuclear war? Yeah, we don't want to be communists. So I collected a group of doctors and we started talking about the medical effects of nuclear war and dropping a bomb on Houston, which digs a hole 3/4 mile wide and 800 feet deep, turning all of that material to radioactive fallout. It vaporizes everyone 5 miles from the epicenter. 20 miles from here in every direction, everyone is lethally burnt with third-degree burns, lying in what is left of the streets. People turn into missiles, sucked out of high-rise buildings, traveling at 100 miles an hour. Pieces of glass traveling at 500 miles an hour. And then the whole area would be covered with a firestorm spontaneously of 3,000 square miles. And even in the middle of winter, everything and everyone burns. There are probably 10 or 20 hydrogen bombs targeted on you as I speak. McNamara and I wrote an article about the fact there are 40 hydrogen bombs targeted on New York. Yet we worry about terrorists. Of the 26,000 hydrogen bombs in the world today, Russia and America own 97% of them. Who are the real terrorists holding the world in the palm of their hands? Russia and America. And yet it's never talked about now. We don't talk about it anymore. And it's more dangerous than it was during the height of the Cold War when I went to see Reagan in the White House and spent an hour and a quarter with him holding his hand trying to teach him about the medical effects of nuclear war. Much more dangerous because the Russian system is dilapidated, its satellites don't work. In fact, in October, the missile silos, and I flew over them yesterday in Dakota and all over, you can look down and see them, hundreds of them, with two men in each armed with a pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behaviour. What if the deviant one shoots the normal one? The locks are 12 feet apart, so one man can't turn both locks. But they've worked out if you tie a string to the one key, one man can turn both locks. In October, they lost all communications with the Pentagon because a computer broke down and nuclear war could have been launched. Nuclear war takes half an hour for your bombs to hit Russia. They pick up your attack and they press their button. It's all over in 1 hour. Yeltsin. Once America launched a satellite from Norway, a weather satellite, and the Russians were warned, but they forgot about it because the Russians are kind of hopeless. And it went up, and they thought they were under attack. Yeltsin, for the first time in history in Russia, opened the football. He was an alcoholic, a bottle of vodka before breakfast, Wernicke's encephalopathy, Korsakoff syndrome. He had his general standing over his shoulder saying, "Press that button, Mr. President." 10 seconds before that 3 minutes elapsed, the missile veered off course. That's why you and I are still here. It's pure luck, and as I look at the data, as a physician, I really don't know how we're still here. Obama gave a speech and said he'd like to get rid of nuclear weapons. And then Senator Kyle, I don't know where he comes from, said we won't ratify the New START treaty that you've agreed with Medvedev to sign unless you give us $850 billion to build 3 new facilities to build new nuclear weapons. That is evil. And I'm fed up with these men who are just... I mean, I wrote a book called Missile Envy, and that's what it's about. It's about their testosterone or lack thereof. Maybe they all should be given Viagra in the Pentagon so they don't have to build missiles. Okay, what do? We can get rid of the nuclear weapons and America must lead because Russia won't. And it's not a symbol of your nationality or patriotism. It's a symbol of pure lunacy. And it was Oppenheimer who developed the first atomic bombs who said, for the first time, physicists have known sin and they've been sinning ever since. And as that bomb exploded with the heat of the sun, the first bomb, and it was called Trinity after the Father, Son and Holy Ghost. And if it hadn't worked, the telegram to Roosevelt was to read, "It's a girl." it read it's a boy. So there's been sexism in this nuclear thing forever. And he saw the bomb explode and realized they'd captured the energy inside the sun. And he said, I have become death, the shatterer of worlds, from the Bhagavad Gita. We've got to lead the movement like we did in the 80s, where in 5 years, I and others, doctors, talking about the medical effects of nuclear war, 80% of Americans were opposed. We got 1 million people in Central Park. I was even asked to address the annual Mortician Society. And I said, well, what do you want me to come and talk to you about? And they said, we don't want to have to embalm radioactive bodies. And I said, don't worry, you'll be one yourself. But they passed a resolution against nuclear war. So, and with Catholic bishops wrote a wonderful pastoral letter, the Methodist bishops, they said Jesus wouldn't like it if we had a nuclear war. So we led the revolution and it led to the end of the Cold War. Gorbachev heard us talk, and so Reagan and Gorbachev got together and ended the Cold War. But the bombs are still there because Clinton had no guts. He didn't take on the Pentagon. He needs to be loved because his father was not. He didn't have a father. He smoked some dope and he never went to Vietnam. So the legacy that Clinton leaves is the fact that tonight you and I, our grandchildren and all life on the planet, maybe the only life in the universe, may be destroyed.
We are listening to Helen Caldicott's talk in Houston, November 2010. We'll return to that in a minute, but let's pause for a second opinion. Here's Tom Lehrer.
This year we've been celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Civil War and the 50th anniversary of the beginning of World War I and the 20th anniversary of the end of World War II. So all in all, it's been a good year for the war buffs. And a number of LPs and television specials have come out capitalizing on all this nostalgia with particular emphasis on the songs of the various wars. I feel that if any songs are going to come out of World War III, we better start writing them now. I have one here. You might call it a bit of pre-nostalgia. This is the song that some of the boys sang as they went bravely off to World War III. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop a bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can see me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah! Little Johnny Jones, he was a U.S. pilot, and no shrinking violet, was he? He was mighty proud when World War III was declared. He wasn't scared, no siree. And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But though I may roam, I'll come back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now.
And as all the bombs drop and all the cities burn, a huge cloud of toxic black smoke rises up to encircle the earth, blocking out the sun for up to 10 years, causing nuclear winter, and we'll freeze to death in the dark and die with radiation sickness, with our hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death. We can fix it, and we've got to lead the movement. I've still got energy, even though I'm 72, and but I need all of you too. And you know, it's everything you do is so important. But the truth is, why immunize our children? Why make sure they clean their teeth if they have no future? And that means from global warming and nuclear winter. So do we have nuclear winter to counteract the effects of global warming? Last but not least is nuclear power. You've got 4 reactors in Texas. You've got 2 reactors 90 miles to the south of you. If they melt down, you're gone. Do you know that the New York Academy of Sciences has just produced a document to say that nearly 1 million people have died so far from Chernobyl? From cancer, from leukemia, homes full of the most grossly deformed children you've ever seen, which we've never seen before in pediatrics or in medicine. Nearly 1 million people, and that's just the start. Much of Europe is still radioactive and will be so for the next 600 years. There are farms in Britain whose lambs are so full of radiation they can't sell the lambs because they're radioactive. I don't buy any European food because you don't know which food is radioactive and which is not. Look at the labels. Close down your nuclear power plants, because if one melts down from usually human error by stupid men doing stupid things, like the man running Chernobyl was a specialist in hydroelectricity, not even nuclear, and he did a crazy experiment, and there was a huge, huge explosion, and he said to his 2 young men, help us, he said, go and see what's happened, and they came back, and as they came back, the control room filled with a white powder, and they said, it's gone. And he said, what's gone? And he said, the reactor's gone. And he said, don't be ridiculous. Go and have another look. It was gone. 1/3 of the inventory or more got out, and some of the stuff like plutonium lasts for 500,000 years, the most carcinogenic substance we know. But your task here is to close down those blasted reactors in Texas. The nuclear industry saying nuclear power is the answer to global warming. That's a lie. Nuclear power doesn't stand alone. It's got to be powered by uranium. And digging up 1 ton of uranium, you have to dig up 1 billion tons of uranium ore. We're full of uranium in Australia. Pumping out CO2 with these huge trucks. This book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, describes that nuclear power produces a hell of a lot of CO2 and CFC gas, which warms the planet. And I'm sick of the nuclear industry lying. But more than that, huge quantities of radioactive waste are being formed every day in this country. 64,000 tons you have with nowhere to put it. It lasts for 500,000 years. There's no container. Titanium, copper, steel, concrete, that will retard its leakage for more than 100 years. And you can imagine future generations waking up in the morning. The food already contaminated with radiation because it bioconcentrates in the food. You can't taste the radiation, you can't smell it, and you can't see it. Strontium-90 lands on the ground. The grass and the roots suck it up and concentrate it hundreds of times, and the cows come along and eat the grass. It's concentrated hundreds of times in the cow's milk. So as this stuff leaks and leaches into underground water supplies and into the food chains, generation heads, they'll wake up in the morning, the baby's already being born deformed or with genetic diseases like diabetes, cystic fibrosis, phenylketonuria, dwarfism. The baby's drinking the radioactive milk, getting their cancer at 6 instead of 60, and a huge epidemics of cancer. That's what nuclear power means. So we've got global warming, which we can fix. The answers are all here, and I kid you not, they really are. We've got nuclear war, which we can fix if we've got the guts and the energy. And then we've got nuclear power, which will lead to epidemics of disease for the rest of time, so we could turn our lights on and our computers. America is full of the most wonderful people, although a lot of them are misguided at the moment, but they really are generous and they care. And it's this country that has to do it. People have come from the four corners of the world to this country. I believe in you. I've lived here for 18 years. You're much more centred, in fact, than Australians, who are terribly cynical. So, good luck, everyone. And if you get up in the morning, look at yourself in the mirror. And if you're not going to do something that day to fix the problems I just enunciated, you're not really living. But we can do it. We will do it. Because we have to do it. Okay? Thank you.
What comments do you have about President Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize, and more specifically, his support of nuclear energy and quote unquote clean coal as our alternative?
Yeah, well, there's no such thing as clean coal. That's a lie. 30 years' time, maybe, but it's a lie. And unfortunately, John Holdren is his science advisor. I know John. He's very much against nuclear weapons, but he's for nuclear power. Chu, his Secretary of Energy, comes from one of those blasted nuclear weapons labs, Los Alamos, I think. He's got the wrong people advising him. He's a lawyer. I need half an hour with Obama. Half, and I won't need to hold his hand because Reagan needed to be reassured. He got very upset. So half an hour, and I'm sure he's got two little girls he adores. Children are 10 or 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. If you live near a nuclear power plant, the children are at high risk of getting leukemia. There's just been a major study done about that. So I'm sure I could turn him around on that if I could get there. The Nobel Peace Prize, it was a little early, and I must say I was very distressed by his speech where he supported the idea of going and killing people in Afghanistan. Thou shalt not kill. I mean, if we don't stop killing each other, we will definitely blow up the planet. We will. What you've got to do is get out and organise. And, you know, I thought of an action called Babies Against the Pentagon, BAP, when the Senate's debating nuclear weapons, you release hundreds of naked toddlers into the Senate chamber and they have to clean up the mess. And the babies are a symbol of what I'm talking about. It's the babies. You know, you've got to be clever. The farmers, there was a bill before Congress and the farmers didn't like it, so they took hundreds of trucks full of pigs and cows and sheep and they released them all over the steps of the Congress and they made a filthy mess. The television loved it, they were all over the place, and the bill didn't get passed. So the farmers won. Got to be clever in this day and age, and above all, totally well-informed.
Helen Caldicott, speaking in Houston on November 12, 2010. Thanks to Scooter over at KPFT for making the recording available. And thank you for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. We have a free email newsletter on request. This will warn you what you're in for if you tune in our next show. To subscribe or to send other feedback, just send me an email, and you'll find the address on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, and as Phil Berrigan said of Dorothy Day, let's keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from up top. true. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No shorthand.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear the speech given by architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, at the Cobo Convention Center in Detroit on February 18, 2017. This was part of the Nation of Islam's Savior's Day event. There were two other speakers addressing 9/11, but I'll only be sharing Richard Gage's speech on the show. The Nation of Islam is wise to 9/11 and see that we've been lied to about what really happened that day, and so held this plenary session called the War on Islam. If you're new to the evidence that contradicts the official and fraudulent account of what happened on 9/11, you might want to go to YouTube and search for a video of World Trade Center Building 7 collapsing as you listen to this presentation. The clip you're about to hear has been slightly edited for radio. So let's begin with architect Richard Gage's presentation at the Nation of Islam's Savior's Day Conference on February 18th. He's being introduced here by the Master of Ceremonies for the event, and I'm sorry I was unable to find out what his name was.
Now that we know something about the history of these false flags and the characteristics thereof, is it likely that another type of false flag is being devised to justify another war, another policy, another political objective? Let's definitely keep that on our mind as we prepare to bring on our next presenter. Now, as you know, our next presenter certainly is no stranger to us. Mr. Richard Gage, who is an architect of nearly 30 years and the founder and CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. This is a group comprised of skilled architects and engineers nearing about 2,500, if I'm not mistaken, along with 20,000 other signers of the petition and supporters that they have backing them up. Now, be mindful, these are scientists, architects, and engineers with verified degrees and backgrounds and experience who know what they're talking about. So, after his 2012 plenary session presentation to us, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan called this man a true patriot. So he's here with us again today to take us further into the science of the collapse of the World Trade Centers. Let's welcome back to the podium our friend, our ally, Mr. Richard Gage. Let's welcome him again, family.
Thank you so much. Thank you. We erected a third light beam in downtown Lower Manhattan to bring to the attention of the American people World Trade Center Building 7, the third skyscraper that collapsed on 9/11. I want to tell you about it. Why? Because it collapsed suddenly, symmetrically, at freefall acceleration on the afternoon of 9/11 by normal office fires, according to the official story. Here's a 47-story skyscraper, be the tallest building in most of our states, part of the World Trade Center complex, across the street from the complex itself. It wasn't hit by an airplane. Yet, on the afternoon of 9/11, well after, 7 hours after the two Twin Towers came down, it collapsed. According to the official story, by these small, few, scattered fires, normal office fires. Office fires have never brought down a skyscraper. There are hundreds of examples of much hotter, longer-lasting, and larger fires in skyscrapers that have never come down. There's good reasons for that. We're going to compare Building 7's features of its collapse to those of typical controlled demolition, beginning with, is there a sudden onset of destruction? This building collapses in under 7 seconds in the manner that you see. What caused its collapse? Is there a straight down, symmetrical collapse? Another feature, number 2, of controlled demolition. Let's take a look from West Street. Yep, straight down, symmetrically, into its own footprint. As you can see here, the center of the pile is in the center of the building. But maybe we're not convinced yet. Let's place a normal controlled demolition on the right. Compare it to World Trade Center 7 on the left. Is there any similarity? Is there enough similarity to warrant an investigation into the possible use of explosives? Yet this was never done. How do they bring a building straight down into its own footprint? You have to place explosives near the columns and beams throughout the building and synchronistically set them off floor by floor. If you don't follow this precise order, the building will fall over. And of course, that doesn't happen. Fire does not have this precision. How fast did the building collapse? You can see it gaining additional distance with every second. It falls, admitted by NIST, in free fall acceleration. That means no resistance from any of the 80 columns in this building. Not one of them gave any resistance. It's as if 8 stories were removed from this building all at once, resulting in feature number 6, the total dismemberment of the steel structure, broken up, ready for loading and shipment. 4 stories tall. How do you get 47 stories into 4 stories? Buildings that fall due to natural causes collapse. You can see a mangled building. Its structural members are not dismembered from each other. Its concrete is not pulverized to a fine powder. Do witnesses hear sounds of explosions? Feature number 7. Kevin McFadden, former Air Force medic, cites explosions, like you'd hear the ground shaking, like the train running underneath your feet. Kaboom! I knew that was an explosion, he says. Do we have enormous pyroclastic-like clouds racing in every direction away from Building 7 at 35 miles an hour with expanding cauliflower-shaped plumes indicative of an incredible heat? Where does that heat come from? We'll take a look in a moment, but it didn't come from the few small scattered fires that you see here that are blamed for the collapse of this building. How about that, a heat? What's causing it? Well, FEMA author Jonathan Barnett, fire protection engineer, cites steel members in the debris pile that appear to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures. It takes 2,800 degrees to begin to melt steel. It takes 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit to evaporate it. Did that heat come from those few small scattered fires? We don't think so. We have the 10 key characteristic features of controlled demolition, direct evidence of explosive destruction. Fire cannot create any one of these, let alone all 10 of them. If fire could have, it would have brought down this building, World Trade Center Building 5, completely engulfed in fire. Did it? No. Fire does not bring down steel frame or any other skyscraper, particularly these small few scattered fires. What happened to the evidence? Carted away at 400 truckloads a day, beginning just 2 weeks after 9/11, put on barges, shipped to where? China, for recycling, before forensic investigators could get their hands on it. Bill Manning cites crucial evidence that can answer many questions on the slow boat to China. Do we have foreknowledge of this building's collapse? Listen to these construction workers hearing an explosion over their shoulder, looking back at Building 7, and then looking straight into the CNN camera and saying this. Keep your eye on that building. That building's coming down. The building's about to blow up. Move it back. Flame and debris coming down. How do they know the building is about to blow up? Did we show, so far, the 10 key characteristics of controlled demolition? Is this direct evidence of explosive destruction? Can fire create any one of these? No, let alone all 10 of them. We believe this is proof of controlled demolition, which is why we now have 2,800 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation, who have also looked at the World Trade Center Twin Towers. We have plane impacts, but it's an hour to an hour and a half later that the towers came down. NIST acknowledges most of that jet fuel burned up in the first, well, outside the building. The rest of it was gone in 10 minutes. After that, for about an hour, we have normal office fires and some damage by the planes. They say that fire caused the sagging of these trusses, pulling in the columns, allowing that portion of the building above the jet plane impacts to crush the building and then crush itself. This is a theory that is completely contradicted by the evidence, particularly the evidence of the fires, which were going out at the time of these collapses, as you can see by the thick, dark smoke clouds. Is there a sudden onset of destruction? And what would produce that? Sounds and flashes heard and seen by witnesses. 118 of them documented in 2005 after a lawsuit forced the city to release this damning evidence of observations of flashes, sounds of explosions, and other phenomena indicative of explosions. Like this, simultaneously, from all four sides, material shot out horizontally, momentarily delayed before you could see the collapse. An explosion in the South Tower, one floor under another. Figured it was a bomb because it looked like a deliberate, synchronized kind of thing. Seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. Seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt. All these explosions. Let's see what they're talking about. The North Tower on the right. Known controlled demolition on the left. Is there any similarity? We'll slow it down halfway for you. Is there enough similarity to warrant an investigation into the possible use of explosives? Especially since it looks exactly like a controlled demolition. Especially since fire, the official cause of these buildings' collapse, along with jet plane impacts, has never brought down a skyscraper ever. Somewhere in the middle of this World Trade Center, there was this orange and red flash coming out. Flash just kept popping all the way around the building, and the building had started to explode. Saw a brief number of light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. I saw flash, flash, flash. Then it looked like the building came down. The building was blowing out on all four sides. We actually heard the pops. You know, you heard the pops of the building with each popping sound, initially an orange, and then a red flash came out of the building. Then it would go all the way around the building on both sides. Let's look at the South Tower. Is there any similarity to a known controlled demolition which we're seeing on the left? The South Tower on the right looks exactly like a controlled demolition. Should it not have been examined? One of the first hypotheses of NIST, rather than completely ignored, especially with all the evidence of testimony of witnesses of explosions. I saw flash, flash, flash. Then it looked like the building came down. I thought the terrorists planted explosives somewhere in the building. That's how loud it was, a crackling explosive. These guys are saying boom, 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 just like a controlled demolition, like you see on TV. Are firefighters credible? We think so. We're told the upper part of the North Tower crushed the rest of the building and then destroyed itself. But as you can see, in the first 4 seconds, it's destroying itself. It's as if it's liquefying, it's telescoping. You can see it here quite easily, in fact. In the first 4 seconds, that upper part is telescoping in on itself. It is destroyed, dismembered. There's nothing left to crush the rest of the building at any speed. Let's take a look at the North Tower starting and now stopping. Just like you heard the firemen say, all the way around the building, symmetrical explosions. None of the photos or videos show an upper section of this building destroying the rest of the building. As you saw, it was gone. What it looks like is more like the volcanic eruption in the Tongan Sea in 2019. Upward, outward, arching streamers, followed by thick white smoke clouds, which are indicative of incendiary destruction, a geometry of fireworks. Let's look at the South Tower. It does begin to tip over. So we have 20 degrees off-center, asymmetrical damage from the loading of this building falling off of itself, asymmetrical damage from the jet plane damage, asymmetrical damage from the fires, how can it have symmetrical destruction all the way down from the top to the bottom in under 12 seconds? Just like the firefighters described, like a belt, all these explosions all the way around the towers. Take a look yourself as we zoom in on those explosions. Are we looking at a collapse or a series of thousands of explosions? And as we zoom in to feature number three, take a look at these individual isolated explosions called squibs here, here. These are coming out at 80 miles an hour, 200 feet per second, 60 floors down up to. These are pulverized building solids. You can see the solids in these explosions. And this tells us, well, these are puffs of air being produced by that pile driver, which is driving down the building. But it was gone. You saw it was destroyed in the first 4 seconds. And if these were puffs of air, they'd blow out all the windows in an open office planning, which these floors were, not these individually charged, isolated explosives that are in this engineered pattern, as you see here, often at the facade, 20, 40, 60 stories below. How fast is the building coming down? Let's take a look. Well, here's 3 seconds, 4, 5, 6, 7. In under 12 seconds, the entire building is completely shattered, its structure from top to bottom. This is near free fall acceleration. The columns are not giving hardly any resistance. These columns, more steel in the facade than glass. What happened to it that it lost all of its resistance? How did it get totally dismembered, feature number five of explosive demolition. Well outside the perimeter of each of the twin towers, broken up into its original 37 and a half foot lengths, these core columns, laterally ejected, feature number six in this case. As we proceed, freely flying structural steel sections, individually freely flying back to three, forward to three, back to three, forward to three. That's 45 degrees. It starts out laterally. What force in a gravitational collapse can send thousands of freely flying structural steel sections weighing 4 tons laterally, landing 600 feet in every direction, shot out at up to 80 miles per hour? Enough force to send a 200-pound cannonball 3 miles. And there are a lot of cannonballs coming out of here. And we're missing 110 floors that should have been stacked up at the bottom in some mangled fashion, but seen. Are they there? No. On the left, we see a two-story pile of core columns, perimeter columns, etc. On the right, in Mexico, we see what we'd expect to see, stacked up floor panels, 90,000 tons of concrete. What happened to it? It's not at the bottom. Oh, there it is, being pulverized in midair by some extraordinary series of explosive forces. Pulverized 200 micron particles, laying 4 inches thick across lower Manhattan. What do they find in that pulverized concrete powder? And in the pile, molten iron dripping from the molten steel, literally molten steel. Molten steel at the heart of the towers remains. The firefighters are describing molten steel flowing like lava from a volcano. They don't see this in office fires. It takes 2,800 degrees to melt steel. Streams of molten metal that leak down the hot cores and flow down. Metal dripping from a beam. A river of steel flowing, says who? The structural engineer that designed these twin towers himself, documenting this. Flowing out of the material held in the hands of this, the jaws of this crab claw, pouring out of the South Tower 10 minutes prior to its collapse. Molten iron, we can tell by its color temperature, by its color, that it is not aluminum or lead or copper. This is iron. And it is very well documented, actually, in the case of Building 7 in the Appendix C of the Building Performance Assessment Report in 2002, a metallurgical examination that uncovers steel that's thinned to almost razor sharpness, holes in the steel up to a silver dollar, evaporation of the ends of the steel beam, an attack of sulfur, eutectic reactions, and sulfidation, intergranular melting, the melting of with iron, molten iron. Where does molten iron come from? Not from jet fuel. Jet fuel is only 500-600 degrees according to its manufacturer. But here we have the presence of sulfur attacking the steel. And this says, well, that can't be sulfur. That must be the calcium sulfide inside the gypsum board. Well, we use gypsum board for almost 100 years to protect steel. It's never turned around and attacked the steel it's designed to protect. So what caused all this steel to melt? Well, let's look and see if there's evidence of thermite. Here's one possibility. The thermite is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. It creates 4,500 degree temperatures in every liquid molten iron, the byproduct of thermite. So here we have a possible source for the massive heat. We have a possible source for the liquid molten iron, and they find in it also, the scientists find sulfur, which is added to thermite to become thermate. So a possible source for the sulfur all in this material. So what else was found, though, in the dust throughout the powdered concrete throughout Manhattan? Previously, molten iron microspheres found by the USGS, billions of them. They don't know where they came from. They're the diameter of a human hair on average, almost naked to the human eye. And R.J. Lee, another environmental consultant, finds these. They're so ubiquitous, they call them a signature element. It's not even World Trade Center dust unless it has these spheres. Up to 6% of the dust is these unknown liquid, previously molten iron microspheres. They're everywhere. Well, here's how thermite reacts. A small experiment. Thousands of what? Aerosolized molten iron forming itself by surface tension into spheres, falling just as you see here. Well, that's found in the dust. They can't explain it. What else is found in the dust, though? Independently collected samples documented by a team of international experts from Stephen Jones in Utah, Niels Harrit in Copenhagen. They document four independently collected samples. What do they find? Red-gray chips, about a 16th of an inch long. There's up to 10 tons of this material. Here's the ones they documented. They come up to a magnet, so they get real curious. And they do a X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy. They find the ingredients of thermite, unignited thermite. So before we had the ingredients of ignited thermite in the iron microspheres, here we have ingredients of unignited thermite. They get real curious. They zoom in 50,000 times with an electron microscope. What do they find? Iron oxide crystals, aluminum platelets set in an organic bed of oxygen, silica, carbon. Very sophisticated material, an incendiary that's been engineered and set with organic material to become more explosive. And just like the results before them, at 420 degrees centigrade, about 800 Fahrenheit, they ignite. What do they produce when they ignite? Iron microspheres. So we know where the iron microspheres came from. They came from these chips. That's extraordinary, internally consistent, self-corroborating set of data that could put a lot of people away for a long time. As if we didn't know where these spheres came from. They're found attached to partially ignited nanothermite chips. It's called superthermite. It's made not in a cave in Afghanistan, only in the most sophisticated defense contracting laboratories. This is all documented in a peer-reviewed paper, Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal. It's direct evidence of explosive destruction. Fire can't create any one of these features, let alone all of them. especially these fires that were going out at the time of these buildings' collapse. So we believe that we've demonstrated the 10 key characteristic features of controlled demolition, that fire can't create any one of them. We believe this is proof of controlled demolition, which is why we have 2,700 architects and engineers calling for a new investigation about the truth about 9/11. Thank you.
And again, that was architect Richard Gage at the Nation of Islam Saviors Day Conference on February 18th, 2017 in Detroit. And the website for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is ae911truth.org.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short hair.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Socialist iconic scholar and activist Angela Davis takes on Trump in the stirring call for protest, linking his victory to America's history of racism and capitalism. She builds bridges between numerous issues and ongoing movements for social change, starting with support for Native Americans, Black Lives Matter, ending mass incarceration and the death penalty, feminism, labor, immigration, and the environment. She calls for robust protests, not organized from the elite, but based upon community and workplace activism, to fight not only Trump, but also a system built on racism and capitalism. And she notes that Clinton's support, even among women, was at best tepid, because she adhered to a bourgeois or middle-class feminism that played down the needs of working class and women of color. And now, Angela Davis on Trump, trying to make America white again.
I want to pay tribute to the indigenous people on whose land we gather. As we contemplate the struggles ahead, as we reflect on the long history of freedom struggles that define the presence of people of African descent, let us also celebrate the determination of First Nations people to protect their land, their culture, their future. And so we stand together with the Standing Rock Sioux in defense of their land, in defense of their water. So much of what is important, so much of what has actually acquired historical significance has been achieved through mass struggle. Yes. Certainly during the last 4 years since we rose up in protest of the killing of Trayvon Martin, the movement for prison abolition. And I don't simply say against mass incarceration, I say prison abolition. Which is also a contestation of carceral feminism. The movement against racist police violence, for black lives, for immigrant rights, against Islamophobia, for feminist movements, more broadly, movements in defense of the rights of trans people, opposition to gender violence, opposition to oil pipelines. Especially the Dakota Access Pipeline, student struggles, especially for accessible education. And accessible education means free education. Free public education. Movement for justice for Palestine. Movements in solidarity with black women in Colombia, in Brazil. And I'm just beginning to enumerate the struggles. And I haven't mentioned that considering all of the justice struggles we're involved in, there is one struggle that you might define as ground zero. And that is the struggle to save the planet. Yes. environmental justice. What was once proclaimed as the advent of a post-racial era, do you remember? Not very long ago. And it's interesting that that turned out to mark the beginning of a new militancy and a recognition of structural racism. And a new approach to struggles for justice that recognizes the intersectionality of all of our struggles. We celebrate our own potential as agents of history in a collective quest for freedom at a time when the forces of capitalism, fueled as they are by racism and heteropatriarchy, threaten to push us back. If there is ever to be any greatness on America's agenda, it must be in the future. And it will consist precisely in the overcoming of the capitalist forces that have impoverished not only so many people in this country, but people all over the world. We know what we have to do, considering the person who will be occupying the White House over the next period represents precisely those forces of capitalism that have impoverished so many of the people who decided to vote for him because they feared for their future. I agree with John Lewis. Is not only an illegitimate president because of what the Russians may have done. His victory was predicated on an institution called the Electoral College, which is an institution of slavery. It was designed to give slave states with small white populations the leverage they needed to acquire power at the national level. In many ways, the inheritances of slavery are still with us. And I think we are beginning to recognize that if we hope to move forward, we will have to get rid of those inheritances. But we have so many relics of slavery that we don't question. For example, the continued use of the death penalty is yet another relic of slavery. Slavery as an institution preserved capital punishment at a time when people upholding this new democracy were arguing that it was an institution that needed to be relegated to the dustbin of history. The death penalty served a very important purpose in repressing slaves who were attempting to achieve their freedom. And we should never forget that the U.S. as a nation was founded on settler colonialism and slavery. And as we talk about these historical modes of oppression, it's important to think in a more complicated way and to how anti-black and anti-indigenous practices are supported and sustained. You know, oftentimes we assume that there are these discrete histories that didn't have anything to do with each other. We have to begin to rethink the history of black people's presence in this part of the world and understand how closely linked that history is to the history of indigenous people. And that also means that we will then more clearly recognize how important engaging in acts of contemporary solidarity can be in terms of building the kind of struggle that will allow us to envision the future. We have a lot of work ahead of us. You know, Donald Trump is going to move into the White House. And there are those who assume that, oh, yes, there's always been a peaceful transfer of power. And this is how we define democracy in the U.S. But, you know, Donald Trump hasn't been so peaceful, has he? You know, particularly in the ways in which he has called for the building of a wall and repeatedly referring to Mexican immigrants as murderers and rapists. So I like the idea of living the legacy of nonviolence. But I also like Dr. King's idea of dramatizing the forms of oppression that exist and making certain that nobody can look away. So our goal is to guarantee that Donald Trump will not be able to govern comfortably. Prepared to stand up. We have to be prepared to show our bodies and let our voices be heard. If you think you've been to a lot of demonstrations in the past, well, multiply that by 100 or 1,000 over the next period. Yes, we are going to have to figure out how to stand together with immigrants who are under attack. That is our responsibility. And we should recognize that the attack on immigrants is a global issue. You know, understand the connection between the attack on immigrants from Central America, from Mexico, Central America, and Haiti, and other areas of the Americas, and what is happening in Europe now. Immigrants from Syria, from Africa. And we have to recognize that at bottom, it is about the inability of capitalism to provide the means with which people can live humane lives. This is an era, of course, in which everything has been globalized, and you ought to praise globalization. Capital travels across borders, and knowledge travels across borders. Products travel across borders. But what happens when people whose ability to live their lives is usurped by these movements of capital? What happens when people then feel impelled to move across borders in order to guarantee futures for themselves and their families? They're called illegals. People, you know, try to live in the only way that has become possible in this era. They're referred to as illegals. There should be No use of that term. No one is believing. No human being is believing. And then when we see the ideological equation of Islam and terrorism, and particularly the attacks emanating from Donald Trump against Muslims and people who look like they might want to practice Islam, because it's actually a much broader attack. And then recognizing that with respect to Islamophobia, it's women who are the first targets. It's women who are the first targets. And some of you saw that photographic image of the armed policeman on the beach in Nice, France, forcing a woman who was wearing a burkini to take off her clothes. This was barely a month after the terrible attack happened in Nice. This woman and her desire to enjoy the beach bore responsibility for the deaths that happened in Nice on Bastille Day. There was a lot of talk about women during the election. You remember? And then after the election, there were those who proclaimed that even though Hillary Clinton, the woman running for office, lost, that 54% of women voted for Clinton, 42% of women voted for Donald Trump. But what is the real story behind these statistics? Because even though it's true that 54% of women voted for Clinton, 53% of white women voted for Trump. And this was supposed to be the era of feminism, right? But so how do we end up with this figure of the majority of women voting against Trump? Do you understand how that happened? It happened because 94% of black women, 94% of black women voted against Donald Trump. And it's not because I'm a black woman that I say that black women are the most sophisticated, the most strategic participants in our political realm. And thank you, my brother. And I think that men, progressive men, should applaud that. Percent of Latina women voted against Trump. So the majority of Latinos voted. But Hillary Clinton was deeply mistaken in thinking that she could use an obsolete notion of feminism. You see, many of those black women who voted for Hillary Clinton did not think that she was their candidate. And I voted for her, but it was a strategic vote. It was a vote designed to prevent the election of Donald Trump. It wasn't a vote for Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton was deeply mistaken in thinking that she could call up this obsolete notion of feminism that focuses on what you might call the categorical woman, and the categorical woman is always racialized, right? When you speak about women, you know, who are you really talking about? And it seems to me that she used this outmoded notion of feminism that revolves around white middle-class women, bourgeois women. And even the notion of shattering the glass ceiling was predicated on the assumption that she was speaking for the women who were all the way up close to the ceiling. Also
didn't use the word capitalism. Did she? Did she use the word capitalism ever? In a critical context?
Hell no.
Well, you know, that was you know, Bernie Sanders who, and that was good. That was good that he did this radical critique of capitalism. But he didn't understand what scholar Cedric Robinson called racial capitalism. He didn't understand that all capitalism is racial capitalism, and you cannot talk about capitalism without also talking about racism. And I just wanted to say a few words about how, when we think about the labor movement, who do we think about? We assume that if the labor movement is ever to be revitalized, it's going to be working class men out there. And we don't realize that the world has changed. We've witnessed the feminization of the global workforce. Not only in terms of the women who are working, but the nature of the jobs. We're talking about domestic work.
Yes.
I will evoke those women back in Montgomery. We're talking about care work. We're talking about reproductive labor. And if the labor movement is ever to rise again, it has to recognize that to organize the unorganized in this day and age means to organize women. Yes. That is where the strength is going to come. Let's think about how change happens. You know, unfortunately, the most intense politicization of people in this country happens around the time of elections. I think elections are absolutely important. But the best elected officials are those who acknowledge the fact that change comes from below. Change comes from movement. Change comes from mass struggle. And we have to stop assuming that all we have to do is vote for the candidate who will bring change. As a result of a politician or two or three or four? Abraham Lincoln didn't abolish slavery. The abolitionist movement, and particularly the black abolitionist movement, black people who were slaves, who engaged in what Du Bois called a general strike, that is what abolished slavery. Did white women receive the vote? And I say white women because we usually hear the term in 1920 women got the vote, but it was white women who got the vote. So when white women got the vote in 1920, was that simply a result of an act of Congress? No, there was a long history of struggle. Unemployment insurance. People think of that as having come to us through the New Deal, but they don't understand that from the era of the Depression on, people were in the streets and they were marching and they had hunger marches and they challenged the government. That's where it came from. Did black people get the vote in 1965 as a result simply of the passage of an act of Congress? So where does change come from? It is more important now to recognize the dynamics of change than ever. He's going to talk about the ways in which the movement against what we came to call the prison industrial complex emerged. You know, now everybody's talking about mass incarceration, right? Even the conservatives. But there was a time when no one wanted to recognize what was happening in our prisons. But there were activists and artists and scholars who persevered over several decades. And now we recognize that something has to be done to remove these machines of destruction from our landscape. And it's not just about ending mass incarceration. It's about ending incarceration altogether. It's about recognizing that under no circumstances have prisons ever been capable of rehabilitating people who are in there. I make these statements knowing that I'm here in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm in the state of Tennessee, which gave the world private prisons. And the Correctional Corporation of America, and then, you know, all of the other private prison companies. And that is connected not only to the crisis we are experiencing in the prison system, but to the detention of immigrants. As a matter of fact, the most profitable sector of the prison industrial complex at this moment is precisely the sector that produces and markets immigrant detention facilities. We have to be prepared to struggle over the next period. We have to stretch our minds and stretch our bodies and our spirits and recognize that we're not just struggling for ourselves as individuals. We're not just struggling for our own families and communities. It is about the world. You know, one of the reasons why we have so many problems in the U.S. is because we fail to recognize the extent to which we are a part of a vast network, what Dr. King called an inescapable mutuality of experiences. And that is going to be, that insight is going to be the insight that allows us to produce the kinds of communities of struggle over the next period that will allow us to get through the next 4 years. Now, when we talk about getting through the next 4 years, because Trump cannot become a two-term president. He cannot become a two-term president. You know, but let us also not be myopic in our vision. And let us recognize that the struggles that we are embracing have a very long history. And that history spans for centuries. But also we have to be able to look to the future and recognize that this history will involve decades and centuries in the future. We need to build community, rebuild community. We need new organizations, new struggles. We need to consolidate our communities. We need to recognize that we will have to struggle over the coming period as we have never struggled before. And I'll conclude with the title of the freedom song that Tammy evoked in her introduction. Freedom, after all, is a constant struggle. Thank you very much.
Angela Davis on Trump, trying to make America white again.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
This study can begin to make a connection between policies that affirm or stigmatize people and their psychological and physical health.
The definition of sex in 64 in 1972 is male and female. It doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in your mind.
Courts for many, many years have made clear that prohibitions on sex discrimination include prohibitions on discrimination against people who are transgender because they are transgender.
And the Oscar goes to...
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Marriage equality laws save teen lives. Moonlight shines after a monumental Oscars mix-up. And Trump flushes trans student bathroom rights. Those stories and a lot more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 25th, 2017. The Trump administration has rescinded Obama-era guidelines for the fair treatment of transgender students on public school campuses. Lawyers from the Obama administration's Justice and Education Departments had argued successfully in a number of court cases that transgender people are protected from discrimination under federal civil rights laws that ban bias based on sex. Trump's Justice Department is headed by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has a deplorable record on LGBT and other civil rights issues. So it came as no surprise that one of his first acts as the nation's top law enforcement officer was to withdraw the federal government's defense of the trans student guidelines in a lawsuit challenging them by a dozen Republican-dominated states. And this week, Sessions spearheaded the official revocation of those guidelines. Surprisingly, new Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, whose record includes support for so-called conversion therapy, reportedly argued to keep the guidelines, citing a potential increase in transgender youth suicides. But insiders say her concerns were disregarded. As you might expect, a diverse number of civil rights groups were quick to condemn the reversal. Some queer activists, in particular, pointed out that Trump's action made his campaign promise to protect LGBT people a lie. We'll have much more on this story later in the program on most of these This Way Out stations.
Finland's parliament has turned back an effort to rescind the Nordic nation's marriage equality law. Legislation opening civil marriage to same-gender couples was passed in November 2014 by a vote of 105-92 and is scheduled to take effect on March 1st of this year. Passage was prompted by a citizens' initiative surpassing the 50,000 signature minimum that supported making the country's marriage laws gender-neutral. But another petition, circulated in recent months by a right-wing group called the Real Marriage Association, gathered about 100,000 signatures, forcing lawmakers to reconsider the issue on February 17th. MP Mikko Karna of the governing Center Party said he wanted to personally apologize to rainbow families who will have to listen to the matter being debated once more. But the vote this time was even more supportive than in 2014. 120 MPs were in favor of marriage equality, and only 49 were opposed. The March 2017 implementation of the November 2014 vote was specifically delayed to allow all the necessary changes to be made to other laws related to civil marriage. Same-gender couples have been able to enter into less-than-equal civil partnerships in Finland since 2002.
Japan's leading housing website is introducing a registry for LGBTQ-accepting property owners. Suumo lists properties for sale and rent across the country. Starting on March 1st, the search function will allow visitors to look for properties that welcome LGBT people and couples. A company spokesman told reporters that there are present conditions where LGBT people are struggling to find property, feeling restricted on living together with their partner in rental houses or refusing to move in themselves, he said. We would like to help them find friendly landlords and support their search for properties. There are no laws protecting sexual and gender-variant minorities from discrimination in Japan, and the conservative federal government rejects any proposals to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. but some local municipalities have been creating mostly symbolic registries for same-gender couples. And a poll last year suggested that a majority of people in Japan now favor marriage equality.
In news from U.S. states this week, the New Mexico Senate voted 32-6 to outlaw the practice of so-called conversion therapy that supposedly makes LGBTQ people straight. Any doctor, psychologist, or other health professional who peddles such a cure to people under the age of 18 could lose their license. Out-Senator Jacob Candelaria, who represents Albuquerque, is the bill's sponsor. When you're a young Hispanic Catholic kid growing up and folks use some horrible words to describe you, both to your face and behind your back, that hurts, he told his colleagues. That is abuse, and I hope we don't adopt the assumption that the only form of abuse is physical abuse. The bill returns to the state house, which is also controlled by Democrats, for a second vote. It's expected to pass there. Conversion therapy for minors has already been banned in California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Vermont, and Washington, D.C.
The Supreme Court of Arkansas on February 23rd unanimously struck down an ordinance banning anti-LGBT bias in the city of Fayetteville, citing a law prohibiting local governments from enacting civil rights protections for groups that are not already protected by state law. Arkansas offers its LGBT citizens no such protections. The justices didn't rule on whether or not the law itself is unconstitutional and sent the case back to the lower court that had ruled in Fayetteville's favor to address that question. But in overturning that lower court decision, they determined that Fayetteville and a handful of other progressive enclaves in the state, like Eureka Springs, that have passed local ordinances protecting their LGBT citizens are in clear violation of existing state law. Tennessee and North Carolina, with its infamous HB2, are the only other states that forbid local governments from protecting specific groups of people from discrimination if they aren't already protected by state law.
And speaking of North Carolina, the NAACP is the latest heavy hitter to urge musical and stage performances, athletic events, and religious conferences to stay away from the Tar Heel State because of HB2. The bill bans local LGBT rights ordinances, but it's best known as a bathroom bill because it also forces trans people to use bathrooms and locker rooms that match the gender on their birth certificates rather than their gender identity. It's had a disastrous impact on the state's economy. Recently elected Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, who foiled the re-election bid of Republican Governor and HB2 defender Pat McCrory, has unsuccessfully been trying to get the Republican-dominated legislature to repeal HB2. He even called a special session just to do that in December that ended in stalemate. The latest compromise being discussed repeals the most odious parts of HB2, but at the same time sharply increases penalties for laws broken in public bathrooms. Local governments that want to pass ordinances protecting their LGBT citizens would be required to notify the state legislature at least 30 days in advance. Most LGBT activists are giving the latest compromise proposal a thumbs down.
Republican lawmakers in the state of Oklahoma are pushing two anti-queer bills. Senate Bill 197 would allow businesses and individuals to cite their conscience or religious belief to overtly discriminate against LGBTQ people or anyone else they don't approve of. Senate Bill 694, just like those enacted in Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina, would forbid local governments from passing LGBT rights ordinances. Critics warn that passage of SB 694 in particular would render the city of Tulsa's Fair Housing Act that stops landlords from denying housing to LGBTQ people and similar local protections elsewhere illegal. Both bills were approved by a state Senate committee this week. Troy Stevenson, executive director of Freedom Oklahoma, said the bills are the most discriminatory in any state in the union and called SB 694 worse than HB2 in North Carolina.
Republicans on a Montana State House committee rejected a bill this week that would have made it illegal to discriminate against LGBT people. The House Judiciary Committee voted strictly along party lines 11-8 to kill the proposal. The bill required a supermajority of 60 or more House members to revive it. That effort fell short by a vote of 55-43. All 41 Democrats voted to bring the bill to the floor, but only two Republicans joined them. HB 417 would have added sexual orientation and gender identity or expression to the personal characteristics for which discrimination is illegal in Montana, which currently include race, creed, color, sex, age, and national origin. LGBT activists in the state have lobbied for more than two decades to get LGBT people added to those categories.
And finally, some far-right Canadian fundamentalists are warning families not to allow their children to see the Lego Batman movie. The editor-in-chief of LifeSite News, John Henry Weston, charges that the film is meant to indoctrinate the little ones into gender ideology and into supporting LGBT rights. He tells readers that the movie promotes gay adoption and is chock full of pro-gay propaganda. Perhaps he's too young or repressed to remember the campy 1960s Batman TV series. Weston's online site, by the way, is an arm of a Canadian anti-choice group called the Campaign Life Coalition. So just how queer could the Lego Batman movie really be?
You want to play games, do you, Batman?
Save the city or catch your greatest enemy.
You think you're my greatest enemy?
Who else drives you to one-up them the way that I do?
Superman.
Superman's not a bad guy.
I like to fight around.
Are you seriously saying that there is nothing special about us?
There is no us. Never will be. Now, I gotta defuse that bomb.
Daniel Reynolds, writing in The Advocate, thinks that if Lego Batman portrays a world where a superhero or his sidekick or indeed a villain could be gay, questioning, or gender nonconforming, it should be celebrated, not criticized.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 25th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
All you people out there who feel like there's no mirror for you, that your life is not reflected, the Academy has your back, the ACLU has your back, we have your back, and for the next 4 years, we will not leave you alone, we will not forget you.
With only a few overtly political statements at the 89th Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Awards in Hollywood on February 26th, writer-director Barry Jenkins' shout-out to the vulnerable was also an odd omen of the Oscars' bizarre climax. In a historically diverse field, Moonlight's Mahershala Ali bookended his Golden Globes win in the same category with a Best Supporting Actor Oscar. He's the first Muslim actor to achieve that accomplishment. Jenkins' co-Best Adapted Screenplay winner for Moonlight, Terrell Alvin McCraney, also spoke up for telling the stories of the disenfranchised.
This goes out to all those black and brown boys and girls and non-gender conforming who don't see themselves. We're trying to show you, you and us. So thank you, thank you. This is for you.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture.
Many had doubted that a movie about the struggles of a gay African-American youth could win Best Picture, but the awards event came to a shocking conclusion that was stranger than cinema. Odds-on favorite La La Land was named the winner, and acceptance speeches had started when producer Jordan Horowitz suddenly announced that Moonlight, not his film, was the actual winner. Chaos abounded as Horowitz handed over his statue to stunned Moonlight co-producer Adele Romansky.
I'm still not sure this is real, but thank you to the Academy, and it's very humbling to be up here. And I think I hope even more than that that it's inspiring to people, little black boys and brown girls and other folks watching at home who feel marginalized and who take some inspiration from seeing this beautiful group of artists.
Oh, hooray for Hollywood! It's really got me. Hooray!
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 Hooray for Hollywood!
Hollywood! Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series. And you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
There was good news and bad news for trans youth this week. For the upside, we turn to Mark Richardson of Public News Service.
New research says state laws legalizing same-sex marriage have brought a reduction in suicide attempts among high school students. The study particularly notes a decline in suicides among gay, lesbian, and bisexual teenagers in those states prior to the 2015 Supreme Court ruling upholding gay marriage. Chuck Smith, CEO of Equality Texas, says laws granting civil rights can have a profound effect on a person's self-image.
The larger takeaway is this is a study that can begin to make a connection between policies or laws that either affirm or stigmatize people and their psychological and physical health.
The study from Johns Hopkins University found in an average year, 3 in 10 gay teenagers attempt suicide, 6 times the rate for straight teens. But in states where gay marriage was legalized, there was a 14% drop in suicide attempts by gay teens. The authors say that while the study doesn't directly link the two events, it suggests additional studies to see if the trend continues. Smith says gay teens are often stigmatized or bullied because of their sexuality, and that laws granting them civil rights can make them more hopeful for the future and less inclined to harm themselves.
If laws and policies are enacted that are affirming of lesbian and gay people's sexual identity, that actually can have an effect of reducing the triggers that could negatively impact mental and physical health.
The research, published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics, reviewed published data about more than 750,000 adolescents from 47 states, with 231,000 identifying themselves as gay. The researchers did not study transgender students. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Step to the left, now step to the right. Put your knees together and squeeze them tight. Keep your arms moving side to side. Try to hold it in till it's time to ride. Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in. I gotta go. Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in.
The Trump administration's Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who consistently opposed LGBT rights as an Alabama senator, has wasted no time gutting pro-queer advances made by the Obama administration. He spearheaded the elimination this week of guidelines for the fair treatment of transgender students on public school campuses. Our comprehensive coverage begins with this edited report by Pacific Evening News anchor Christina Onestad.
What the Obama administration did is they issued guidance.
Chris Hayashi is executive director of the Transgender Law Center.
And that guidance was really to provide schools with support in complying with existing law and to make sure that they were supporting all students in their schools.
The debate was raised in the wake of a bill passed last year in North Carolina that bans transgender students from using restrooms of their choice. Based on Title IX, a federal law prohibiting sex discrimination in education, the Obama administration issued the directive allowing students to use a restroom that matched their gender identity and also sent a warning that schools could lose funding if they didn't comply.
The Obama administration is ideologically rather than legally motivated.
Matt Staver, founder and chairman of the Liberty Council, supports lifting the Obama directive. He says it does not enforce Title IX.
Title IX uses the word sex. It was something that was drafted back in 1972. It goes back to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and the definition of sex in 64 in 1972 is male and female. It doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in your mind. It doesn't have anything to do with a boy or a girl thinking that they should be treated or identified as the opposite sex.
You're a mean one, Mr. Trump. You really are a heel. You're an electoral fungus topped with cotton candy hair, Mr. Trump.
With more on the story, we've got enhanced highlights from the February 23rd coverage on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
According to press accounts, there was a split in the Trump administration over the issue between Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. The New York Times reports DeVos initially resisted signing off and told Trump she was uncomfortable because of the potential harm that rescinding the protections could cause transgender students. At a meeting on Tuesday in the Oval Office, the president sided with Sessions and pushed DeVos to drop her opposition, which she did. DeVos later issued a statement saying in part, quote, "This is an issue best solved at the state and local level."
Save our schools! Protect trans students! Save our schools! Protect trans students!
Hundreds of protesters gathered outside the White House to call on Trump to protect transgender students. Participants included Gavin Grimm, a 17-year-old transgender student in Virginia whose lawsuit against the Gloucester County School Board has gone to the Supreme Court.
No matter what happens, no one, not even the government, can defeat a community so full of life, color, diversity, and most importantly, love. Amen.
Mara Kiesling of the National Center for Transgender Equality also spoke outside the White House.
The worst case scenario is what is already happening. Children all over the country are scared by this man. They are really worried that they're going to go to school tomorrow. They're going to be bullied. These are kids who have to go to school all the time worried about being bullied by other kids, being bullied sometimes even by educators. And now they have to worry about the Attorney General of the United States and the President of the United States bullying them. It's just not okay.
To talk more about President Trump's decision to roll back protections for transgender students, we're joined by Chase Strangio, staff attorney with the ACLU's LGBT and AIDS Project. The ACLU is representing Gavin Grimm in his Supreme Court case.
The protections that the Obama administration clarified in the guidance last year were incredibly important for this community that is so vulnerable to violence and bullying in schools. What's important, though, is that as much as the Trump administration may want to change federal law, it's still in the province of Congress and the courts. And so yesterday's actions, while sending a terrible message to the young people who are going to school in this country, young people who face incredibly high rates of suicide and harassment, it does not change the law. And that's important because the protections themselves come from Title IX, they come from the Constitution, and the president himself and his executive agencies cannot change that.
So this Supreme Court case that has been brought by Gavin Grimm will determine what happens?
Absolutely. Yesterday's actions just highlight just how important this case is. This case before the Supreme Court involving Gavin Grimm, the 17-year-old boy from Virginia who's being barred from the common spaces at his school just because he is transgender, his case is before the court.
Now, what do you mean? Explain just he's being barred from the common spaces.
His school has passed a policy solely because his principal and his guidance counselor and the people closest to him at the school said, we understand that you're a boy. And you will be allowed to use the boys' restrooms and other facilities just like other boys. And his school board decided that that was unacceptable and passed a policy targeting him, explaining that he and he alone is not able to use the shared restrooms and has to be banished to a separate, isolating, faraway, and stigmatizing restroom. And he filed a lawsuit. The case is before the Supreme Court. The case is not mooted by yesterday's actions because the question before the court is, well, what does Title IX mean when it comes to transgender students? And courts for many, many years have made clear that prohibitions on sex discrimination include prohibitions on discrimination against people who are transgender because they are transgender. And the reality is that kids will be harmed by this. And you know, I can't say it more strongly, but the blood is on the hands of these lawmakers who are making it a priority to make vulnerable kids feel less safe.
President Donald Trump was asked about transgender rights when he was running for president and appeared at a town hall event on NBC's Today Show. This was last April.
Mr. Trump, please be specific. Tell us your views on LGBT, how you plan to be inclusive as president. Speak about North Carolina bathroom law in particular.
Oh, I had a feeling that question was going to come up. I will tell you. Well, look, North Carolina did something that was very strong, and they're paying a big price, and there's a lot of problems. And I heard one of the best answers I heard was from a commentator yesterday saying, leave it the way it is right now. There have been not very few problems. Leave it the way it is. North Carolina, what they're going through with all of the business that's leaving and all of the strife, and that's on both sides. You leave it the way it is. There have been very few complaints the way it is. People go, they use the bathroom that they feel is appropriate. There has been so little trouble, and the problem with what happened in North Carolina is the strife and the economic punishment that they're taking. So I would say that's probably the best.
Do you have any transgender people working in your organization?
I don't know.
No?
I really don't know. I probably do. I really don't.
So if Caitlyn Jenner were to walk into Trump Tower and want to use the bathroom, you would be fine with her using any bathroom she chooses?
That is correct.
So Caitlyn Jenner could use any bathroom she chooses in Trump Tower, a candidate Donald Trump said. But President Donald Trump has gone with a very different approach.
You know, that was a surprising amount of clarity from then candidate Trump on the issue. And I think what it reflects is that when people first think about this, it makes perfect sense to not worry about where people go to the bathroom, because actually we've all been using the bathroom, trans people and non-trans people alike, for a very long time with no problems. And the emphasis on trying to expel trans people from the bathrooms we've been using for decades is, in fact, creating the problems. I think what we've seen now in his shift of position is, you know, he's being caught up in the rhetoric that is really about demonizing trans individuals and making it seem not palatable to share public space with us. But that's just simply not a tenable position.
I have a message for the trans kids of America.
Caitlyn Jenner.
You're winning. I know it doesn't feel like it today or every day, but you're winning. Very soon, we will win full freedom nationwide, and it's going to be with bipartisan support. Finally, I have a message for President Trump. From, well, one Republican to another. This is a disaster, and you can still fix it. You made a promise to protect the LGBTQ community. Call me.
The reality is that there's a movement of people supporting the trans community. Trans people are out there speaking for themselves. And that to the extent people's answer to the question of what to do about trans people existing in the world is to tell us not to exist at all, that is just simply not tenable, and people will not stand for that. And I know that we will continue to march forward, and we will continue to stand beside the young people, particularly, who are taking on so much.
So what happens next, Chase?
We tell everyone in this country to mobilize around the Supreme Court case that's happening with arguments on March 28th, because that is where we will continue to make our case for the protections that transgender individuals need. And we will stand in solidarity with all of the communities being targeted by this administration.
And if a child or anyone is harassed in school, wherever, what can they do?
If a child is harassed, if they're denied access to the restroom, they can contact their local ACLU office. They can contact any organization that works with the LGBT community in their state. They can find me on Twitter. They can search for other people who are out there. We will not be silent. We will not let people be isolated and targeted, no matter how much targeting happens from the federal government and down into the states.
Chase Strangeau is staff attorney at the ACLU. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michelle Marie Gurkison and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Special thanks to Mark Richardson of Public News Service, Pacifica Evening News anchor Christina Anastad, and Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, the Gay Chemist Support Fund of Horizons Foundation, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WWUH West Hartford, Connecticut, Aero FM, Masterton, New Zealand, CITR, Vancouver, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
To Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the run-up to the 2008 financial crash, which took down much of the world economy with it, economists and the media blithely looked the other way and insisted that the fundamentals of the U.S. economy were just fine, despite the appearance of a massive housing bubble. Similarly, in the late 1990s, before the dot-com bubble burst, experts declared that the stock market could only go up and that we were living in a so-called new economy, where the laws of motion of the past no longer applied. And arguably, we're now in the peak of another boom, with an overheated housing market and unemployment levels finally going down, which will end up again in bust. That's the history of capitalism, but it's a history, as a sublime documentary illustrates, which is willfully forgotten over and over. The film is titled Boom Buzz Boom, and it's made by Terry Jones of the hallowed British comedy group Monty Python. As one might imagine, it's not the usual dry exposition of mind-numbing theory. Jones tells the history of speculative booms and busts with song, puppets, animation, even a clip from South Park, and of course with a range of economic critics from left journalist Paul Mason to Nobel laureate Paul Krugman and actor John Cusack. While the audio from the documentary can't do justice to the content of the film, we're going to forge ahead anyway and play you some edited excerpts to entice you to support Against the Grain and KPFA in the second week of our winter fund drive. Here's a cut from Boom Bust Boom.
Financial crises aren't some new thing that we're going into now. We've had many financial crises. The 19th century is filled with financial crises, and even the 18th and 17th and 16th century. And then when you start looking at all these different examples of economies and their financial systems and their crashes, you start to get a much better understanding of what financial crisis is about.
The seeds that were sown were the same seeds that were sown in all previous crises. So if we look to what works and what doesn't, no better lessons are there than those from history.
mania started back in 1562 when a ship from Constantinople docked in Antwerp. Aboard was a cargo of tulips, the first to be seen in Europe.
All tulips, precious tulips, I kiss you with my tulips. Make me healthy, make me wealthy, tulips, precious tulips.
The tulips proved to be a sensation amongst the rich merchants of Amsterdam, then embarking on their golden era. The merchants built grand houses surrounded by flower gardens, and the star of the show was the tulip. Tulips grew in prestige and popularity, and prices began to soar. By 1636, a tulip bulb could be worth a new carriage, two grey horses, and a complete harness. Some bulbs were reportedly changing hands over 10 times a day. It seemed like everyone could make money if only they bought tulips. A kind of euphoria gripped everybody. But on February the 5th, 1637, it all came to an end. At a tulip auction in Haarlem, in the Netherlands, only the sellers of tulips turned up. There were no buyers. Haarlem was at that time in the grip of bubonic plague, so perhaps that's why no one wanted to go out and buy tulips. But the damage was done. The bottom fell out of the tulip market. Bulbs that had commanded the price of 5,000 guilders sold for 50. This is what economists call a bubble.
Well, a bubble is a financial episode in which the price of assets, whether it's tulips or equities or gold, basically becomes completely detached from any intrinsic value.
That being in a bubble is like, it's a state of extreme hope and excitement and stupidity.
And it can continue for as long as people believe that there is something magical or new about the valuation today.
In every boom and bust cycle, there is a period of exceptionalism. This time is different. Everything is different. And there's always a cool excuse. And things like, oh, well, you know, our demographics are different. Or, you know, this time interest costs really are very low. And, oh, inflation has been solved. Or, oh, there's a boom in gold mining. Or, you know, tulips are the first ones. This is the first time you'll ever be able to buy these tulips, and you must get in now. There's always a reason why one should suspend your rational faculties and buy into this. And normally it's because you look around and you see everybody else doing it.
In 1711, the British government was deep in debt to the tune of £9 million. A couple of entrepreneurs named Edward Harley and John Blunt devised a scheme to rescue the government. Instead of repayment, anyone to whom the government owed money was obliged to accept shares in a company called the South Sea Company. At the same time, the South Sea Company was given the exclusive right to the monopoly of trade with South America. Conveniently overlooked was the fact that Spain, with whom England was at war, controlled all the trade with South America and had done so for 200 years. But hopes were high, and the scheme was a phenomenal success. 1713, the war ended. Spain then allowed Britain precisely one ship a year, of no more than 500 tons, to trade with South America. And one quarter of the proceeds was to go to the King of Spain. Not exactly a winning scheme for a bankrupt country. And in 1718, the war with Spain broke out again, and the company's assets in South America were seized. And any prospects of profits from trade disappeared overnight. Unbelievably, hopes were still high. The South Sea Company talked up the value of its potential trade with South America, aided by politicians and members of the government who were in on the act. and the price of shares rose from £128 in January to £330 in March, £890 in early June, and finally £1,000 in early August. All good bubbles have to burst, and the South Sea bubble burst in a spectacular fashion. From £1,000 in August, the stock fell to £100 by the end of the year. With the collapse of the stock price, thousands of people were ruined, including Sir Isaac Newton, who lost the equivalent of £2.4 million, and about which his niece reported he never liked to talk about. Newton said, "I calculate the movements of stars, but not the madness of men." I hope he included himself in that. The South Sea bubble is a perfect example of what is called euphoria.
One of the things we have to control is this tendency for people to go through these periods, sort of mass euphoria and mass pessimism.
When people become very optimistic about the future and they project this optimism into the prices of assets, there can be an asset bubble. And prices go up, and when prices go up, people say, oh, seems like people are optimistic about the future. I should be optimistic too. And so I buy those assets, and that pushes the price up a little more.
Prices move completely out of line with any sort of reality or any earnings basis or in housing market, any sort of income basis, and it becomes a self-fulfilling bubble.
If you think you're investing in tulips because you can always sell the tulips to somebody else at a greater price, you're not investing. You're speculating. And there is a difference. One has a real impact on the economy. The other is just people handing money back and forth and hoping that after a while, when the music stops, they'll be the one who isn't holding the parcel and who is holding the money. And again, that's okay. Let them do that. But just don't do it with your family home and all your money.
When you're in a bubble, you can't see outside of it. So there's no way of actually knowing or recognizing it as it's happening. It looks like success. It feels like success, which is even more dangerous.
Bubbles of the past, you know how they ended. And when they ended, you understood why they had ended. This one hasn't ended yet, so it's completely different from your memory of the others.
It's very hard to remind yourself of that. In the boom times, because everyone else is making a lot of money, and you naturally want to make a lot of money with them. And if you don't, in fact, you're kind of a fool.
It's one of the really great mysteries of economics, that if everybody decides it's okay, it really is okay. And if everybody decides it's a disaster, it really is a disaster. So everybody believing it is a certain way makes it a certain way.
From the 1950s to the 1970s, John Kenneth Galbraith was probably the most famous economist in the world.
Recurrent descent into insanity is not a wholly attractive feature of capitalism.
J.K. Galbraith was vociferous about speculative euphoria and about why periods of speculative euphoria just keep on happening over periods of time. It's very much human behavior. But also our failure to be able to deal with the worst consequences of that euphoria.
And that was an excerpt from the documentary film Boom Buzz Boom. My name is Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain, and this is our second week of our winter fund drive. And I'm very pleased to be able to offer to you the full length. It's almost, I think it's more than 70 minutes long, documentary by Terry Jones, Boom Buzz Boom. It is not your ordinary documentary, as you may have already gleaned, even just from the audio. It is made by Monty Python's Terry Jones, and it tells the history of speculative booms and busts that are part of the DNA of capitalism. It tells their history in a way that is remarkably accessible through animation, through puppets, through song, as well as interviews with people like James Galbraith or Paul Krugman, or various other economic critics, and we are offering it to you as a thank you gift for your pledge to KPFA. For $100, you can get the film Boom Bust Boom by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And I should say it is a digital download, which means that when you pledge, you will leave your email address and you will get an email. In email, you'll get a link sent to you, which allow you to watch, to download the film. And it's fantastic in all sorts of ways. It saves us extra money for shipping, so that means more of your donation actually goes to the working of the radio station. You can also watch it on whatever device you so choose, whether it's a smartphone or a tablet or your laptop or your smart television or whatever, and you get it instantly, or almost instantly. You get it right away, whereas normally you have to wait 6 to 8 weeks to get thank you gifts from us. So yours for a pledge of $100, Boom Bust Boom, this film by Terry Jones. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or kpfa.org. You can find it on kpfa.org. Just click on the support link. And then on films, and you will find Boom Bust Boom there under the films listed for a $100 pledge. We have a lot more audio to play in this hour, so please note this number, 1-800-439-5732. We're going to return now to more from Boom Bust Boom.
The disreputable history of financial euphoria goes on and on. The 20s was an age of prosperity, but the wealth wasn't shared evenly throughout the population. In 1929, the top 5% of the population received approximately one-third of all personal income. Now, the richest 5% of humans can't eat more than the rest of us, so they are compelled to spend their money on luxury items, such as property, or invest in stocks, thereby hoping to increase their wealth. Not only the wealthy, but middle-class Americans were displaying what John Kenneth Galbraith described as
an inordinate desire to get rich quickly with the minimum of physical effort.
The stock exchange in New York boomed. In May 1928, the volume of shares reached 5 million, an all-time record. The trouble was that many investors weren't using their own money. They were borrowing money to buy stocks. This is known in the financial world as buying on margin. Say you have $200 and you borrow $800 more to invest $1,000 in stocks. If the price of stocks goes up 30%, you make 150% profit. After you repay the $800, you now have $500 for yourself. But if the price of stocks goes down 30%, your stocks end up being worth only $700. But you still need to repay the $800. You now owe the bank $100. The problem is that borrowing money to buy stocks, buying on margin, although it amplifies the gains, it also amplifies the losses. You could end up owing money to the bank without having a penny left. By the end of 1928, folk were swarming to buy stocks on margin. In other words, speculation had taken a hold on people like never before.
Never before or since have so many become so wondrously, so effortlessly, and so quickly rich.
You might say, what is the difference between speculation and gambling? Well, a journalist, Will Payne, explains in this edition of World's Work.
A gambler only wins because somebody else loses. When you invest in stocks and shares, everybody wins. One investor buys shares in General Motors at $100. He then sells it to another for $150, who sells it to a third for $200. Everybody makes money.
It's like conjuring. Continually pulling rabbits out of hats, and like conjuring, it's an illusion. What Will Payne forgot is that the stock prices could also go down. But as long as the price of stocks is increasing, everybody is happy to run with it. Roger Babson, an entrepreneur and business theorist, started to warn about a market crash as early as 1926.
Sooner or later, a crash is coming. Factories will shut down, men will be thrown out of work. The result will be a serious depression.
24 October is the first of the days which history identifies with the panic of 1929. That day, almost 13 million shares changed hands, many of them at prices which shattered the dreams and hopes of those who owned them. By 11:30, the market had surrendered to blind, relentless fear.
Thousands of speculators who previously had only seen the market rising now discovered the problem with buying on margin, as brokers sent telegrams demanding huge amounts of cash.
This was the case in 1929 when the overinflated American economy and the stock market, which fueled it, crashed. By the end of the year, banks all over the country were closing their doors as frightened people clamored to reclaim their savings.
The 1929 Wall Street crash was a deep and prolonged crisis, different from some of the previous panics in history. It combined euphoria with massive borrowing. And speculation combined with borrowed money is the most toxic combination in capitalism.
We came out of the Great Depression with hardly any private sector debt. Households and firms were not very indebted, partly because they went bankrupt, partly because they paid down debt. And for generations, Americans were afraid to get into debt. Corporations were afraid to get into debt. Okay, but gradually over time, because the economy performed fairly well, gradually the memories of the Great Depression faded, and the new generations became more willing to borrow, both households and firms. And these debt ratios started to climb.
In the United States, if you look at the long sweep of history, you discover that there have been two great peaks of private debt as a share of income. One of them occurred in 1929, the other one occurred in 2008. The road to financial crisis often, at least, begins with the private sector getting careless about debt.
It's all about that. People took on large amounts of debt, hoping that sort of wonderful things would happen in the future that would allow them to repay them.
Nothing is ever learned for long. We forget. The people who learn those lessons, who live those lessons, die. And their children view the Great Depression as we view it, as a historical episode.
But why does it happen time after time throughout the centuries? In the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the economist Hyman Minsky proposed the financial instability hypothesis.
After a deep depression, governments impose regulations on the financial world. There follows a period of stability. But the problem with this stability is that it breeds overconfidence. Overconfidence leads to financial euphoria, during which time the politicians relax the regulations. This then leads to excessive borrowing, and excessive borrowing and euphoric bubbles cause instability.
Yeah, Hyman Minsky used to say, stability is destabilizing. It causes people to get overconfident. It causes people to forget about the underlying nature of the system, that it's inherently unstable. Inherently unstable.
But it's a powerful hypothesis. And the hypothesis actually is basically that there are long cycles in which people forget about the dangers of debt, forget about the dangers of being highly leveraged. That goes both for borrowers, for lenders, for government regulators, everybody. The last financial crisis recedes into the fog of memory, and that sets you up for the next one.
He predicted that financially complex capitalism creates crashes, creates massive booms and busts that can, on some occasions, reach the scale of 1929. So 1929 can happen again.
And that is the voice of left-wing journalist Paul Mason, as featured in the film Boom Bust Boom. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain, and I'm here to raise money for Against the Grain and KPFA and to entice you to pledge your money to support this vital institution. And as a thank you gift for your pledge, I'm really happy to offer to you today a really unusual documentary about financial crises, speculative booms and busts, made by none other than a Monty Python. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. Pledge $100 and get the digital download of this film, Boom, Bust, Boom. And I should just say how that works is we will send you a link to your email address, and then you can download the film, watch as many times as you want on any device that you see fit. It saves us some money because we don't have to pay for shipping, so more of your donation goes to doing what you want to do, which is to fund this radio station. And this documentary is a joy to watch. I really can't do justice here, even with these excerpts. You can get a sense of the richness of the sound in it, and obviously the insights of the people who have been interviewed in it. But it tells the story of capitalism's history of boom and bust in a way that is unusually accessible. It uses song, uses animation. There are these sort of Muppet-like figures. In the excerpt that we heard, we just heard about the economist Hyman Minsky, and in that piece of the film, they actually talked to Minsky's son, Alan Minsky, who happens to be the program director at our sister station, KPFK, in Los Angeles, and a fantastic person. He talks about his late father, and they use puppets to help explain the ideas of Hyman Minsky. And part of what they're doing is in the film is asking, why do ideas like Minsky's get forgotten by economics? And Minsky's argument was that capitalism is inherently unstable, and that there are these illusions of stability. So after a crash, people start getting overconfident, and then regulations can be removed. And we see that, of course, all the time, the push towards deregulation. And then you have the cycle repeating itself over and over again. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call if you'd like to pick up this thank you gift, or if you'd like to just say no thank you gift at all. I'm happy to give all my donation straight to KPFA. We appreciate that. We appreciate whatever you can give. If you're able to give a lot right now, I'd like to encourage you to do so. And one way that perhaps might suit you is we're also offering a combination of Boom Bust Boom, which is by itself a $100 pledge, with the 6 DVD set Capitalism, which we played excerpts from on Monday. It is the wonderful 6-hour documentary about the leading economic ideas of our times and how they were shaped and their implications, from Adam Smith to David Ricardo to Thomas Malthus to Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes, and Karl Polanyi. You can get that set, which you, if you'd like to just pledge for it by itself, is a $240 pledge. But I'd like to encourage those of you who can afford to do so to think about getting the 6-hour, 6-part set Capitalism and Boom Bust Boom for a $300 pledge to KPFA. If you're able to afford that, wonderful. If you're not able to afford that, we totally understand. Just give it at whatever rate you can. But think about the importance of KPFA, because one of the things that Boom Bust Boom really brings to light is how blithely the mainstream economics and the mainstream media, I should add, really ignored all the signs of the last bubble bursting. But we did not ignore it here on KPFA. We gave voice, we gave a place for radical and left-wing economists to talk about what was going on, to the signs that were apparent as we're heading towards the crash of 2007-2008. And I would like to think we are here now as arguably another bubble is building to shed light on that and not pretend that normalcy is a lack of crises. In fact, normalcy is, under capitalism, crisis after crisis. How they play out, how severe they are, may vary, but they are part of the reality of capitalism, which is something that corporate interests and hence the corporate media tend to want to paper over. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. I'd like to return to more audio, but I just want to say that now we're into March. You may be thinking ahead about April and taxes. And this is just a friendly reminder that your donation to KPFA is fully tax deductible to the largest extent allowed by law. We are a nonprofit, and if you give a flat amount and say no thank you gift, the entire amount goes to KPFA, and hence the entire amount is tax deductible. If you'd like to get a thank you gift, then I think it's about 10% of your donation is not tax deductible, but the other 90% is. So it's a wonderful way to divert some of your money to a venerable but never taken for granted institution that has been shining the light on the deprivations of the system for a very long time. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org. Let's return now to more from Boom, Bust, Boom.
Every generation thinks it's smarter than its parents and its grandparents, and it never proves to be the case.
What happens is a crisis fades into memory, and then it becomes history.
That is the reason we often give for why we study history and why we teach history, is to not have to repeat the mistakes of the past.
Have you ever seen a State of the Union address where the president comes on and says, guys, we're f***ed?
And I have said before, Mr. Deputy Speaker, no return to boom and bust.
Human strategies we're seeing in real markets are just evolutionarily really old. They're kind of leftover strategies from 35 million years ago.
It is very hard to understand why economists focus on models in which crises could not occur.
They run the economy based on science fiction models.
And it's why they had no idea this crisis was coming, because they ignored banks' debt and money.
We always thought how lucky we were that we never actually had to live through a 1929 crash and the 1930s Great Depression, because we're cleverer now and we know how to avoid these kinds of accidents. And actually, a lot of economists were absolutely adamant that the worst would not happen because we know how to deal with these things. Of course, the truth is, we didn't know how to deal with it.
In 1928, President Calvin Coolidge gave his State of the Union address in the following terms.
In the domestic field, there is tranquility and contentment, the highest record of years of prosperity. The great wealth created by our enterprises and industry and saved by our economy has had the widest distribution among our own people. The country can regard the present with satisfaction and anticipate the future with optimism.
He didn't know what we know now, that the United States was about to suffer the worst economic disaster in its then history.
Thank you.
Our economy is healthy and vigorous and growing faster than other major industrialized nations. The American people have turned in an economic performance that is the envy of the world.
He didn't know what we know now, that the worst crisis ever to hit the Western economies was just around the corner. The crisis of 2008 is often referred to as the subprime crash. In less than 15 years, there was a huge rise in lending mortgages to people who basically couldn't afford them.
Ladies and gentlemen, Harvey Rosen, chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, speaking in 2007.
The main thing that innovations in the mortgage market have done over the past 30 years is to let in the excluded, the young, the discriminated against. The people without a lot of money in the bank to use for a down payment.
This reckless lending to people who couldn't afford a mortgage became known as subprime lending. But the banks insisted they had eliminated risks by statistical processing.
When you look at how banks manage risks, particularly before the crisis, this is very interesting and quite funny, actually. What they did was to take risky assets, such as junk mortgages, slice them into little bits, repackage them after mixing them with other risky bits, and then sell them on to other banks and financial institutions. And so these risks became dispersed in the financial markets, and nobody really knew anymore where the risks were, or for that matter, nobody knew exactly whether the package of financial products that he was buying, that he was investing in, was risky, whether it was very risky or not risky at all.
They sold these packages to investors as very low-risk products.
Banking organizations of all sizes have made substantial strides over the past two decades in their ability to measure and manage risks.
So because we could not observe risks anymore, we were telling ourselves there is no risk. What's even worse, when you do this, risks become connected with each other. You don't know exactly how the risks are connected, but they are.
In the pre-crisis period, we told ourselves a story about the bigger banks being able to spread their risk across their balance sheet, which would then allow us as regulators to enable them to run with lower safety margins.
Everybody was happy and confident that the mortgage market had become more efficient than ever.
And I have said before, Mr. Deputy Speaker, no return to boom and bust.
Our economy is healthy and vigorous and growing faster than other major industrialized nations.
Everyone was convinced that this time it's different.
The subprime crisis of 2008 was essentially a bubble bursting.
They lent lots of money against houses. I've seen them in Gary, Indiana, in Detroit, Michigan, that you can now buy for 10 grand. But they'd lent usually about 100 grand so that poor people who'd never ever owned a house before could own a house.
In 2004 to 2005, more than a third of all mortgages were no income, no job or assets that were nicknamed ninja loans.
That's what this was about. It was about forcing loans onto people who would never repay them, who would end up getting foreclosed in order to earn a fee on the origination, and another fee when they were sold to some sucker who would take the loss.
The whole thing becomes eventually a bit of a con trick because everybody thought that asset prices would continue to go up.
The unimaginable happened. Housing prices started to fall.
That signaled to them that they could never pay that debt because they were relying on the house price to rise, as we all do in these bubbles, and then, like a string of dominoes, the very risky lenders knocked over the risky lenders, knocked over the normal lenders, and then they all fell apart.
The banks were taking on more and more risk, investing in the financial economy instead of the real economy. The financial economy, as it's become, is essentially making money out of money instead of investing in firms and companies and contributing to the real economy. So what happened to the banks and insurance companies that got involved in the subprime lending?
You can think of the end of 2007, what happened? The bank starts looking a little more carefully at their balance sheet. They look at the assets they've got and they say, wow, a lot of those assets are trash. Okay, we know that these things are bad, a high percentage of them. And some of our assets are the IOUs of other banks. I wonder if their balance sheets are as bad as ours. And they sort of think, you know, they probably are because we're all doing the same stuff. And then they say, you know, maybe when that loan comes due, we should call it in. Say, we're not going to renew it anymore because we think maybe you could get in trouble and we won't get paid. Suddenly, all the banks started doing this. And basically, that is when the global credit markets froze up. Banks wouldn't lend to each other anymore. And so that turned into a massive liquidity crisis, and that is what set off the whole thing. So this layering of debt on debt, financial institutions owing other financial institutions, turns out to be extremely dangerous.
News waking up to the American investment bank Lehman Brothers has filed for bankruptcy in New York. That's happened in the last few minutes. It means the Wall Street institution, which has been in business for 150 years and survived the Great Depression, is now the most high-profile casualty of the credit crunch.
It was not only Lehman Brothers that went bust. In the U.S., Citigroup were rescued by the U.S. government with guarantees to the tune of $300 billion. AIG were bailed out for $182 billion.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
Bear Stearns was taken over by J.P. Morgan after the U.S. government secured them with a $30 billion guarantee. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, government-backed mortgage lenders who were involved in the subprime mortgage lending, were rescued by the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Merrill Lynch was taken over by the Bank of America. In the U.K., the Royal Bank of Scotland was bailed out by the U.K. government for £20 billion. HBOS was bailed out for £13 billion and Lloyds for £4 billion on exactly the same day, October the 13th, 2008.
Money don't get everything, it's true, but what it don't get, I can't use, I need money.
I remember sitting in a room, a bit like this one, at the Treasury back in 2008. Around the time of the Lehman crisis. We sat there. During the first half hour of that meeting, the share price of one of the biggest banks in this country fell by 50%. In the second half hour of that meeting, the share price of that same bank rose 50%. We knew at that point this wasn't Kansas anymore.
I mean, if the 2008 crash didn't wake people up, I don't know what will.
And that is John Cusack speaking in the film Boom Buzz Boom, directed by Terry Jones of Monty Python. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on KPFA. I'm here to raise money in the second week of our winter fund drive, and so pleased to be able to offer such an educational and yet really amusing film as a thank you gift for your donation. Obviously, what you're really getting here is you're getting KPFA through thick and thin, through booms and busts, through times of tumult like we clearly are living through right now and have been for a while. So really, you're supporting KPFA, first of all, Against the Grain, hopefully as well. And this is just a thank you gift, but it really is a tremendous thank you gift. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. You can also go to kpfa.org. $100 gets you the DVD download, Boom, Buzz, Boom. And what that means is we'll send you an email link in your email to the film, and then you can download it on your computer, your laptop, your smartphone, your tablet. There are all sorts of ways you can watch it. And it saves us a bit of money because we don't have to pay for shipping. And one very nice thing about it is you get it very quickly as opposed to having to wait to have something mailed to you. So it is a great way to support KPFA, and it's a great thank you gift to get. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org, where you can go and click on the donate link and you'll find it under films. One of the things that this film explores, and of course we're just playing portions of it, we don't have time to play the whole thing, but one of the things that it explores is how economics is taught and how economic history is not taught. And in the United States, I think so many of us don't have the opportunity to learn about economic history, and it really influences both what people think is possible, but also people are much more likely to be swept into speculative sort of manias, really, where people can end up hurt terribly from them, as we saw with the housing bubble. Obviously, this is not just a question of human behavior. This is a question of institutions and regulations and an economic system driven in pursuit of profit. Educating yourself does matter here, and I think making sense of the world around us really matters, politically and otherwise. And there have been some fascinating polls about the attitudes that young people have about capitalism, and the very large percentage of young people who are skeptical about the system. And yet, knowing the history of capitalism often eludes all of us, whatever age we are. So this would make, I think, a fantastic gift, because it is extremely accessible as well as intelligent. It isn't dumbed down, but it tells the story of speculative booms and busts in a way that is really a joy to watch through animation, through these very clever puppets. They're not, you know, these aren't sock puppets, through song and through some very trenchant critics speaking about the history of booms and busts in the history of capitalism. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call and pledge to KPFA. Easy to remember, is 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. I also encourage you to go to kpfa.org, where you can pledge for this thank you gift or any other. And we're also offering in this hour the six-part series Capitalism, which we played excerpts from on Monday. It's a $240 pledge, and it spans the history of economic thought from Adam Smith to Karl Polanyi, and looks at the context in which ideas arose. If you'd like to, and I'd really encourage you, if you're able to do so, you can get the Boom Bust Boom, which we've been playing excerpts from today, with that series for a $300 pledge to KPFA, and you can talk to the people who answered the phone about breaking it down into six monthly installments if you like, or you can pay it in one fell swoop. And don't forget that your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. And I'm running out of time, but there's so much from this film that I'd like to share with you. So we're going to just go to one little clip from Boom Bust Boom, but please keep calling 1-800-439-5732.
The conventional economic model, which is used to run the economy, is known as the free market or neoclassical economic theory. And it is based on the idea that we are all rational when it comes to money, that the economy will always find itself in an equilibrium, and that bubbles simply can't happen.
So if I put it really at its simplest, you build a model where you say, we assume depressions are not possible.
That, unfortunately, is not the world we live in.
Conventional economists don't like to model debt into their economic models because debt makes the models unstable. So they omit it altogether. It's modeling what is easier to model rather than what is happening in the real world.
They will not break away from these 19th century heuristics that they thought would make it easier to solve the problem. In fact, it made it far harder, and it's why they had no idea this crisis was coming, because they ignored banks' debt and money.
It was a serious, serious professional problem. We had a situation, to compare it to doctors for a second, real doctors, we had a situation where the patient was bleeding, but we didn't really recognize the presence of blood.
And that is Stephen Kinsella, an economic historian who is featured in the film Boom, Bust, Boom. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's Against the Grain. We have the hour is, we're running out of time, and I've been handed a match of $600 to be hopefully matched by you, our other listeners. Bailey in Venice and Marie in Los Altos have put together $600 as a challenge to other listeners to pledge right now. So if you've been sitting on the fence and thinking about pledging during this drive or during this hour, there is no better time than to pledge right now. But you only have 7 minutes in which to do so. So please go to your phone and call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org. In the cut from the film Boom, Bust, Boom, which is yours for a $100 pledge to KPFA, we talk about the economic models which mainstream economists use to predict the future. And they say that these economic models don't include debt, and they don't include in their models crises happening, which leaves you to wonder, how can we trust mainstream economics and, by extension, the mainstream media, which often just takes mainstream economics as a given, in both predicting the future and actually explaining the past? And if that is the case, then I think it's a very strong case for supporting an institution like KPFA, which is one of the very, very few outlets for radical economists to come on and question mainstream neoclassical economics and question the assumptions of mainstream economics that that the future is always rosy, that there are no crises that can happen. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Right now we have $600 on the line. We really need to make this match. I'm not sure how we've really done this hour so far, so I'm hoping we can get a flurry of people going to their phones. If you don't want to get the thank you gift Boom, Bust, Boom, you might think of just donating outright or going to to kpfa.org, where you'll find lots of thank you gifts on offer, including the six-part series Capitalism for a $240 pledge. Whatever you do, though, now is the time to do it. We've got 5 minutes left, $600 on the line, and much-needed money to raise for an institution that really runs on a shoestring. And, you know, if you think, well, I don't really understand how to put this all together in my head. You know, there are these crises and are we expecting another one, and what might happen in the future? Well, I think those are all very important questions, and having a place where they can be explored is really important. But I also think we need to remember the political implications of crises. There was a very interesting report that came out where some scholars looked at elections and crises in 20 industrialized economies going back to the 1870s and found that in the majority of cases following financial crises, the far right benefited. So this story, Boom, Bust, Boom, is not just the history of capitalism. It's not just the history of 1929 or the tulip craze, but it's actually the history of Donald Trump and why he's where he is, and right-wing populism that has been sweeping portions of the world. It's very much connected to these financial crises, and I think connecting the dots is so essential. 4 minutes to go. This $600 countdown is on. We need to be able to make this money. I'm hoping that you will join in and affirm your commitment to KPFA and say, yes, I believe this institution matters. I think it's really important that there's a place where systemic critiques can take place, where questions about conventional wisdom in economics and politics take place on a daily basis. And I want to support it. I want to be part of it. I want to join it collectively. And, you know, wonderful to get these thank you gifts and your tax deduction and so on. But I want to be part of making this happen. Well, you can do so right now by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or going to kpfa.org. We have 3 minutes left to make this match. We are a third of the way there. $600 is on the line. Won't you please help us make it? We need you right now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can get this terrific thank you gift, Boom Bus Boom, or many other wonderful thank you gifts online. But ultimately, what you're getting is KPFA. And it is a wonderful feeling to actually join in, whether it's for the first time or you've been a subscriber in the past, to join this institution, because it really is one of the few places where alternate discussions of economic and political orthodoxy take place. There are a lot of things where you can see sort of criticisms are based on a lot of superficialities, but a kind of systemic critique really doesn't take place hardly anywhere, and certainly not in the mass broadcast media. But here's KPFA beaming to a third of California. It is a vital institution, but one that can never be taken for granted. So if you'd like to keep it going, if you think it's really important it's here, if you think that it's really essential that in these Trump years there is a KPFA standing firm and vital and able to do the kind of coverage and analysis that you have come to depend on, then please step up right now while we have the $600 challenge on the line and help us make the money that we need to stay on the air. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We've got less than a minute and a half to go. We are now two-thirds of the way toward making the $600 match. So please, as I say, if you've been thinking about it, you just haven't had a chance to do it, well, this is a time where your money will go furthest. So I'm really encouraging you to pledge right now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Won't you be the person who puts us over the top? It would be so sad to have to go back to Bailey and Marie and say, we got really close, but we weren't able to make it. We know there's the support out there for this institution. We know that there's the support out there for Against the Grain, that a lot of you really believe in the work that we do here, that you believe that ideas actually matter, that history matters, that getting a grip on the dynamics of society are important because they have important political implications for the kind of activism we choose to take. If you're in agreement with that, then please stand up for us right now in our hour of need when we have a match on the line. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.